Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day is casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, April 30th, 2021. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, it's Casual Friday, folks. We look back on the week that was with Alex Perine, writer from the New Republic, host or co-host of The Politics of Everything. And then we'll be talking to Lucy Steiner, the co-host of the AM Quickie at amquickie.com and the new podcast, The Kump, K-U-M-P. Meanwhile, vaccination pace slows in the country. Cases, however, drop in 34 states. New York Times reports that Rudy Giuliani investigation is centered on the firing of the U.S. ambassador to Ukraine. Meanwhile, a confession letter by a now cooperating witness in Florida claims that Matt Gaetz paid for sex with a minor. Labor Secretary Marty Walsh says gig workers should be treated as employees. Pfizer begins to export COVID-19 shots to Mexico. Florida passes the next version of GOP's assault on voting. The FDA will ban menthol cigarettes. Congressional Democrats vowed to pursue inclusion of Medicare expansion in the American Families Plan. Let's see. Registered nurses at Maine's largest hospital vote to unionize. And lastly, Missouri legislature rejects results of a popular referendum and votes down Medicaid expansion for their own citizens. All this and more on today's program. It is Casual Friday, folks. For those of you who are watching the program, you can see I am wearing a soft collared shirt, as I do on Fridays. Emma is here. She is in her Casual Friday wear as well.
Sort of. I wear this sweater when I feel like it, basically.
Yeah, that's why I said, you know, sort of. Yeah, sort of.
Well, it's cozy, and, you know, I like to feel cozy on Friday. How about that?
Cozy Fridays. There you are. Yeah. For me, it's Casual Fridays. For you, it's Cozy Fridays. Fair enough.
Exactly.
Folks, quite a week. Thanks for joining us. Glad you can make it. We are now into the second 100 days of Joe Biden's administration. I should say the first 100 days of a presidency. And I don't know if I actually knew this or I have just simply forgotten about it. I was reminded by Heather Parton, who is a frequent guest on this show, that the first 100 days was became a thing because of FDR's first 100 days. And how much was accomplished during that. And I think it's been a while since more was accomplished in the context of first 100 days. That said, the tasks at hand are quite large. Certainly in terms of COVID, we have 34 states where the numbers are going down. Vaccination rates have been slowed significantly. people are speculating as to the reasons why. We could have hit sort of the natural limits of the sort of pent up demand for the vaccine. And then you have certain communities that are difficult to reach. You have low income folks who don't necessarily have the same relationships with medical, with hospitals and with medical providers. You have maybe, you know, some of these mass vaccination places require a lot of travel and people can't take off work to go there. And then you have people who are reluctant to take it or just don't take it seriously. There is some conjecture that the pause in the Johnson & Johnson vaccine scared people. It's unclear. We need more data with that, but that's where we're at this point. But we will see what comes in the next 100 days of the Joe Biden administration. And I think for all intents and purposes, if this could be the last 100 days where we could see the potential for anything happen, maybe 150 days, 120 days. But if it doesn't happen now, it's hard to imagine it's going to happen anytime later, the closer we get to midterm elections.
Well, I think you feel the air kind of leaking out of the balloon a little bit. And then you, as David Dayan pointed out yesterday, you hear the shadows of austerity talk from Joe Biden creeping back in, which he'd kind of shunned beforehand, which was a welcome change. But there is some sort of a shift happening now, and it's up to all of us, I guess, to keep the pressure on. But there's only so much you can do to kind of such an old school president, I guess.
Well, and it's also just a function of like how, you know, what tact will they take with Joe Manchin? And I would say it's not austerity that we're hearing from Biden as much as it is deficit hawkery.
And yes, that's and what so I meant to say. Yes.
There's no one out there pushing any type of cuts. It's really just a question of like this concept of pay for, which is used more often than not as a way of preventing expenditures on.
Yeah, on Casual Friday, I use the wrong words for things and misspeak. So that's,
oh, that's all right. Every day I mispronounce things. So that's just part of every day that ends with a Y. But one of the things that we spoke about with Dayan yesterday was the idea that there are two separate components to this. There is the taxation component and there is the spending component. Now, let's put aside for a moment the reconciliation requirements that these things, you know, or the Byrd rule that there are certain spending proposals that need to be revenue neutral for a moment. Dayan is, from his conversations in his reporting, sees these two components as severable. Now, I don't personally think that we need to worry about paying for these things at all or the deficit. However, the desire to raise these taxes has to do with wealth inequality. And so there is actually a proactive reason to raise these taxes. He seems to think that there is more opportunity for the Democrats to coalesce on the spending side of the equation. So it's interesting when you see conservatives, you know, and I don't want to do the old, the hackneyed sort of version of like, oh, it's just a bunch of white guys sitting around a table with cigars and with, you know, and scotch or something as a way of explaining what, you know, Republicans are about. I know that's old timey and just a meme and it's a silly idea, but here is a bunch of Republican conservatives sitting around a table, smoking cigars, drinking scotch, complaining about taxes.
I was screaming at the television when he's talking about taxes. Yeah. Because what he is saying is so obviously asinine. When he says that rich people don't pay their fair share in this country,
yeah,
that is just an abject, disgusting lie. It is a lie. The top 10% of income earners in this country pay all net taxes. Not some of the net taxes, all of the net taxes, because net taxes are defined as what you pay into the government minus what you get back from the government. So if you get back from the government more than you paid in, this means that you were not a person who paid net taxes into the government. Only the people at the top of the spectrum are paying net taxes in this country. All of the net taxes in this country.
Yeah.
When he says they're not paying their fair share, the only thing he means by they're not paying their fair share is it should be nearly all of your income goes to the federal government. And when he says things like, I'm not going to tax anybody who's making under $400,000 a year, he is lying to you through his teeth. When he says I'm going to tax corporations, corporations are not human beings for purposes of taxes. The money that would have been passed on to you via income is being taxed up here. That money is now being withdrawn from the system and taken away from you. Corporations are going to have to raise prices in order to deal with the taxation effects. When he says that I'm going to tax all of these rich people on their capital gains taxes, what do you think those rich people are going to do rather than put their money in the stock market where they get taxed on capital gains? They're not going to put their money in the stock market. So what happens to your 401k if you're a union member or a teacher's union member? What do you think happens to all the other 50% of the population who are invested in the stock market right now? And what happens to the businesses that hire you when Joe Biden decides that your boss needs to be taxed out of existence in order so that he can determine where the dollars go? This jackass who's never created a single job in his entire life.
The people who don't pay their fair share in this country are the poor. We need to raise taxes on the poor. I'm not joking. I'm not joking. The poor in this country pay zero. The lower middle class in this country pay net zero. So we have a group of people who pay no taxes, a group of people who pay no net taxes, a group of people who pay all the net taxes. And his argument is that it's category three who don't pay their fair share. Fair share means your percentage of taxes. We've determined that there are some people who shouldn't pay any percent of taxes. The only fair taxing system is one in which everyone pays.
I love the idea that A, they have decided they're speaking from authority as to, like, here's the definition of fair. Here's the definition of what fairness is in taxes. This net taxes sort of metric that they have decided. Let's get to the part about the taxing of the poor in a moment, because they all laughed at this guy when he said that. Even these jokers thought that was a joke.
Right.
But let's just start with the idea of net taxes. First of all, no one assesses whether you're paying enough taxes based on net taxes as to what you get back from the government. Because if that was the case, then we would spend a lot of time chastising all the red states that get more back from the federal government than they do from New York and California. If we were talking about fairness in that respect, New York and California would have more of a say in the way, in the Senate, for instance, as to what the taxation is, because they put more money into the federal government than they get out relative to these red states. So that assessment is absurd. Joe Biden should have said no household that makes more than $400,000. It's really technically $560,000, because you do not see a raise in your taxes unless your household makes, you joint file because you're married. If you together are making over $500,000 each year, that's when you start to see a small raise in your taxes that is a fraction, literally a fraction of what it was back in the 50s and the 60s. So the idea that this is absurd is ridiculous. The idea that corporations are not people for the purposes of taxation is just something that Ben Shapiro decided to make up.
Well, I mean, are they people when it comes to donating to politicians? Do they have free speech rights? I'd love for him to contend with that, given his new posture that they're only not people when it comes to taxation, Sam, but they're people with rights when it comes to every other way that corporations want to influence politics and policy.
Forget the hypocrisy. There's no, these rules don't grow on trees. They're where what society decides.
Well, look at Bill Gates. Like, Bill Gates is somebody who pays a lot of taxes, but the government certainly covers Bill Gates. Like, he's getting his value for money with regards to how the government, say, protects his IP, for instance.
That's the other point.
They couldn't exist without the government.
On one hand, they will celebrate American exceptionalism. But when it comes to assessing how much America has provided for them, the ability to make these obscene amounts of money, never mind our government structures that benefit the rich, mortgage interest deduction, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All of these things, The idea that you're not getting from the government anything when you're making hundreds of millions of dollars or even $500,000 annually as a household, the idea that you're not getting something from the government that other people aren't is just absurd. Of course you are. Yeah. Of course you are.
And of course he chooses net taxes. Again, this absurd, just out of thin air. And the facts don't care about your feelings guy doesn't bring up the report that informed a lot of what Biden is doing about how the richest 1% are dodging more than 20% of their taxes. And that is just a plain fact. But of course, I guess it was written about in the Washington Post. So it's the fake news media. And just back to the poor argument there where they all laughed at him. Who is that guy, by the way?
I have no idea who that dude is.
It's Jeremy Boring. He's one of the founders alongside Ben Shapiro.
Okay. If the poor aren't paying enough taxes, how are they, like, that he wants them to be even more poor? Because if they're tax dodging and they're not paying their fair share, they're still impoverished. It doesn't make any sense.
Well, they all left because they like people being impoverished.
Yeah.
They want people more impoverished.
It's hilarious.
As they drink scotch and puff on cigars, what a ridiculous segment. They're so overly concerned with like this old madman-esque performative masculinity and making people know that this is who they are. And Ben Shapiro, he just looks so out of place in that kind of situation, you know?
I watched that thing and I was just like, did none of them look around and go like, geez, guys, we're like a parody of ourselves. Can you believe this? Like, can't we just like,
they think it's cool.
Don't we have a woman, you know, anywhere in the office that we can just have sit on set so that we can actually just make it look like we're not a parody of ourselves.
But that would be virtue signaling and caving to the radical left.
There you go. All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Alex Perine. Folks, I have been trying to cook for the kids again, starting to, or I've been thinking about it. And frankly, a lot of times it's too difficult. And so during much of COVID, we were doing a lot of takeout, a lot of quick meals. I've had services in the past that I've talked about that where they deliver food to you and you cook it yourself. But I found over time, like, this is getting a little bit too intricate for my culinary abilities and time. I wanted something a little quicker, and I wanted something with a little bit more flexibility because Myla has been at home from school. She's going to still be home for a while. So I wanted something that maybe we can do some lunches and, you know, sort of flexibility. Well, so classic Kelly, we don't refer to her as old Kelly because she's not old, but former Kelly, I was talking to her about it and she said that her sister uses HelloFresh. And so I'm going to get some stuff from HelloFresh and we would advertise for them. With HelloFresh, you get fresh, pre-measured ingredients. They got great recipes. You don't have to go to the grocery store. They're going to make cooking easy. And the thing about HelloFresh, my understanding is that not only do they have over 20 different recipes each week, vegetarian meals, and they're tested and designed by chefs and all this, but you can make your meals in 20 minutes or less. And that is what I am looking for. I don't need to have a sink full of dishes with 14 different bowls that I've prepped things into. I'm sorry. I am not a gourmet cook. I want something that's going to be fresh and delicious, but also easy. Plus, they have an app that makes it super easy. I played around the app. You can add a breakfast here or a lunch for certain days or days. So I've got Myla covered. HelloFresh is 28% cheaper than shopping at your local grocery store. It is 72% cheaper than a restaurant meal, without sacrificing any quality. In fact, Newsweek named HelloFresh the most trusted meal kit company of 2021, with over 4 million households served. So this is what Classic Kelly's sister has told me about some of the meals. The one that I am looking forward to the most, I will have to say, is the pecan crusted chicken with lemony apple salad. It is in the easy and low calorie category. I'm trying to shed my COVID weight. Chicken is coated in a creamy honey mustard sauce and covered with pecans, panko, which I don't know what that is, and butter, which makes for a crispy coating after some time in the oven. Lemony mixed greens with apples, extra honey mustard sauce for dipping. Complete of the meal as soon as the chicken is cooked to crispy perfection, under 30 minutes of prep time. That's what I want. I guess panko is breadcrumbs, Brendan's telling me. All right, good. I'm looking to try it out. And that is, you know, so instead of like frozen chicken fingers for Saul, bingo, bango. Go to HelloFresh.com/majority12 and use the code majority12. You will get 12 free meals, including free shipping. That's HelloFresh.com/majority12 and code majority12 for 12 free meals, including free shipping. Let me know what you think about that, folks. Remember, we'll put the links in our podcast description. And today's program also sponsored by SunsetLakeCBDs.com. If you head over to SunsetLakeCBD.com and use the coupon code LEFTISBEST, they give you 20% off of gummy bears. They give you 20% off of the tincture, which helps me sleep. They have different milligram doses. And so you can get like the 3,000 milligram, which occasionally I'll go to if I really got to get to sleep, and then I'll taper if I don't. They have the smokables. They have the smalls, which Matt loves to mix in with his other smokable stuff that is now legal in New York State. We also have, the fudge, the CBD infused fudged, and the CBD infused coffee beans. Sometimes they have Kenyan roast. Sometimes they have Central American roast, Guatemalan roast. Check it out. All delicious. They have those dog treats that almost good enough for human beings to eat. I can tell you that right now, firsthand experience. Check it out. They're a great company, mostly employee owned. The they pay a minimum wage of $15 an hour. They are 100% organic. They are pesticide free. They use integrated pest management and agricultural practices that they work with the University of Vermont, who are big in cannabis cultivation. So check it out. Great company, great guys over there. They're fans of the show. Left is Best gets you 20% off. All right. Let's welcome to the program the co-host of the Politics of Everything, the writer from the New Republic, Alex Perrine.
Hey, I'm having video problems for some reason.
He is having video problems. he is just a blank slate, folks.
I am, yeah.
Maybe we can put up a picture of Alex in post. So, Alex, welcome to the show. I'm here with Emma Vigeland. Well, I want to talk about a little bit about, you know, Biden's first 100 days, but you've written a couple of pieces over the past couple of weeks that I thought were fantastic. I mean, I always read you, but these I thought really were interesting. So let's just start with talking about, you know, where you think we're at with Joe Biden 100 days in. Oh, there you are. 100
Hello. Days.
I got to say, I genuinely thought like, oh, he just didn't want to take a shower today.
I'd be honest with you if it was something like that.
So where do you think we are? I mean, like, you know, we keep saying, you know, we've gone back and forth with this. Joe Manchin seems to have been all over the place. I don't know if you heard as we were characterizing David Dayen's reporting that maybe the tax and the spend provisions of these bills may be severable in the minds of the White House, which might make it easier to coalesce around the spending side. What's your sense of all this?
I mean, it's my sense is that it's hard to give a, and I think I said this exact same thing when I was on like a month ago. It's like really hard to give us to give a sort of grade or score to this when so much is still unknown in terms of like what we're actually going to get out of this Senate this year. Right. I think that there's been a lot of talk about, you know, the sort of ideological break or evolution and that the thinking of the Democrats based on what Joe Biden has proposed. And then, you know, a lot of it then just comes down to like the same sort of Senate negotiations that I can remember seeing the last time we had a Democratic majority there. Right. So I don't know. It feels difficult to judge where we're at yet, which just seems funny to say after, you know, 100 days.
It's true, but on some level, I feel exactly the same. On some level, that's like, that's a good situation because it is not clear yet that Joe Biden is a complete disaster.
Right.
Right. I mean,
that's
the alternative at this juncture, unless of course they had already moved forward. But the alternative would have been Joe Biden has proved to us that he is not going to pursue anything.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But you know, one thing that he did recently that did not get much attention was requiring federal contractors to raise their minimum wage to $15 an hour. I mean, that's going to impact, you know, potentially tens of thousands of people, you know, around the country. And it is going to have a nominal impact on, you know, upward pressure of wages across the board. And it didn't get much attention on some level, but it does feel like the Biden administration responds to pressure. But it's got to be big. Like, we're going to find out in 15 days where they are with their refugee cap. They
sort of revisited
that.
Yeah.
At the same, and there's, you know, they're starting to now like provide waivers for the Title 42 stuff at the border. They should get rid of all of it.
Right.
But they wouldn't have gotten rid of they wouldn't even have like be making these concessions without pressure. It does seem to be, at the very least, the most malleable of administrations.
And I think that's definitely a difference, I think, in receptiveness to being pushed. That's a difference between what now and the early Obama years to me, I think, because I think we can all recount the sort of Rahm Emanuel led decisions that led to it. But in those Obama years, it was like sort of like Obama was defining himself as the, you know, progressive guy in the room, and they didn't want any of this outside pressure. They were completely doing it inside, like negotiation with senators. And you get the sense from the Biden administration that there are people in it who are saying, in order to get us to do the right thing, you need to apply pressure and it needs to be real, you know? I think there would have been like, there's definitely more of an openness, even to, you know, having people push, reluctant senators to do things and stuff like that, that does feel new. And it's sort of silly and annoying that they have to be like you have to raise a big stink to get us to do the right thing, but that's better than just telling everyone to shut up and like not lobby them at all.
Well, that kind of, you know, pairs with what Schumer was trying to tell people and basically say, you need to write in and tell Joe Biden why he needs to cancel $50,000 of student loan debt, which he still hasn't done at all or moved at all on. Yeah. It's like so artificial to me, because does he really need handwritten accounts of why student loan debt is crippling people throughout the country? I mean, he's been toying with this, and they were going to create a task force that was going to research and all of this stuff. And there's been no movement there.
Yeah. I mean, the student loan thing in particular is one where I think they don't want to admit they have this authority for a lot of reasons. some of which I'm not even pretending to understand all the reasons, but they want to push it to Congress and not sort of take responsibility for it. And part of that is just like, I think, an accounting thing. I don't know if you read that Wall Street Journal piece yesterday. I think it was yesterday. It was basically like, because student loan debt held by the federal government is considered future revenue, like the deficit on paper will rise enormously if you cancel a bunch of it, you know. And that's really silly Washington arguments, but that's the kind of thing that like that drives decision making by U.S. senators and by people in the White House.
On that notion of like of pushing them, I mean, they definitely, I mean, I don't know. I don't really have a sense of what it's like to work in the White House, but I imagine it is basically just like, what's the biggest fire?
Yeah.
Right. Like where, like, honestly, like, where are we getting the most amount of heat from?
Yeah.
And that's the way that they go about this. And I would imagine, particularly with a guy like Biden, who does not seem to have really any sort of, you know, political agenda beyond being sort of that guy, you know, that yeah. good guy in, you know, like in the middle somewhere. The size of the fires end up dictating what's happening, what they respond to. And on some level, like we haven't seen the fires on student debt. But I also think like, you know, and I don't think this came up in our conversation with Dayan, but you know, they had done that big spread on all the executive actions that Joe mm-hmm. Biden could take. I think that I think there's going to be two sort of rounds of assessments, right? One is going to be Joe Biden's ability to get the Senate to pass at least what, you know, some semblance of what he pushed, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we got a sense like, you know, he had ran on dropping the Medicare eligibility rate to 60 and then didn't put it in his own American right. Families plan.
Yeah.
Which makes me feel like he, at the very least, saw that plan as having a chance of being pushed, right? I mean, because he's already put himself out there as being supportive of that. So putting it in the plan and having it jettisoned wouldn't have come with any type of political cost. But he sort of backed off that. So I do think that he wants that American Families plan to pass in some form or another. The question is going to be, can this guy who sort of like pushed himself as the, you know, the guy who can work the Senate, even with the Republicans, can he get his own Democrats to do what he's saying?
Yeah.
And then he moves into the, well, if you can't, are you going to start doing this executive action stuff?
Right. Yeah. right. And that's the thing is like, I don't think it's the reason he won the nomination, and I don't think it's the reason he got elected, but that was his argument for himself, is like, I'm the realistic like guy who has relationships in Washington. I've been around and like, I know how to get things done. And at the time, I think mostly assumed it was like, the argument was like, how are you going to get along with the Republican Senate? That's crazy. Like, Joe, you don't have the power to get things through Republican Senate. And now we're not dealing with the Republican led Senate for now. And I think it's like, it always, I don't know, it, like, do they have a strategy? This is the question, because I feel like there's a lot of just trust us, we've got this with this administration in that when you ask that sort of question, which is like, what is your actual like legislative strategy here? Because, you know, we've had after the giant rescue package, there was a lot of like, all right, how many more of these are, do you think that the Senate's going to be able to do this year? And then there's a lot of like, they're kind of just like, we'll figure it out. Like, trust us. We're going to, you know, we'll do it later. And, you know, I like, what is the actual, like, what's the strategy to get Warner on board with the PRO Act? You know, what's the strategy to get Sinema to say yes to anything? Like, we still don't really know.
It's funny when they respond, when people respond, like, do you have a strategy? Trust us, as opposed to like, yeah, we got a strategy. We're not going to tell you. Like, you don't have
right,
the confidence to say that.
right.
Like, you really get the sense that, like, it's like, well, you know, let's see what the biggest fire is tomorrow.
Yeah.
And That's a little scary. But your point about the Republicans, the Republican Senate not being there, is a good segue into a piece you wrote a couple of weeks ago, the case for more canceling. You know, we just before you came on, we played a clip of, you know, six guys at the Daily Wire attempting to show their masculinity by smoking cigars and drinking scotch, or at least putting the scotch performatively. I mean, talk about
right in the virtue. Center of the table. Exactly. Right, so you can see it from every angle.
Talk about virtue signaling. Here's my cigar and here's my, you know, scotch. I got news for you, folks. I drink too, but when I drink on air, you don't see the bottle. That's the way you really drink on air.
You pour in a coffee mug, folks.
Exactly. But the point being that they were, you know, talking about the taxation instead of the spending.
Right, right.
And and you wrote a piece about the case for more canceling, which was sort of like indicative of they're just adrift, like pursuing just completely irrelevant stuff. And that's a good thing from your perspective. Elaborate on your piece a little bit.
Sure, yeah. And I wrote it basically just after the peak of the sort of Dr. Seuss canceling hysteria.
It's just so weird that you even said that word, those words.
I know. and, you know, my argument is that, like, basically, like, why not just give them shiny objects to be distracted by to distract them from doing actually substantively evil things, right? Because, like, you know, I don't buy this sort of strict divide between cultural politics and everything else. Like, all of it is intertwined, and the Republican culture wars have, like, actual victims when they're going after, like, trans kids and things like that. But when they are angry about quote unquote woke capital, like, they are just raging against an imaginary dragon in their minds and doing no harm to anyone. Like, Marco Rubio threatening Disney or whatever is a Marco Rubio who's not, like, actually proposing to do something real.
Ted Cruz had a Wall Street Journal op-ed 2 days ago saying, like, hey, you guys are just used to us automatically giving you tax cuts. He just gave away the game. And then he said, but now that you're taking a position I like, we may not give you those tax cuts. Yeah. It's pretty stunning. And we should say they're still, Florida just passed a anti-voting bill just the other day. I mean, people should not misunderstand. These corporations are not really, really helping. I mean, they're, you know, drawing public attention to it. And maybe that'll have some knock on impact that will hurt Republicans down the road. But you know, what the Republicans are doing is to insulate themselves from that.
In state legislatures, especially if, like, giant corporations don't want something to happen, a state legislature doesn't pass it. I mean, that's just, like, you know, there are exceptions, but, like, it's so easy to influence, like, what does and doesn't get voted on in a state legislature in the United States. Okay. That, like, yeah. So
did Delta speak out against that Georgia voting law after it happened? Was that the case? Because I think Delta has a massive presence in Georgia, but
I think I might have to double check, but I feel like it was after, but I'm not actually on.
Right. Which to me, then it's like, okay, we're all just doing a live action role play here where the corporations get to pretend to be woke and the Republicans can for a moment pretend to be anti big business and big corporation, and then everything just goes back to normal.
Well, right. I mean, you saw the same thing after January 6th, where all these companies were like, we are suspending political giving. And it was because the cycle was over. Like, literally, the election was done. The cycle was over.
They don't get money at this point anyway. It's like they said, we'll suspend it for 6 months, which is basically what happens after the election.
Yeah, exactly. Time. Yeah. Right. We're going to, we will suspend political donating until there's an election that we want to influence.
Right, exactly.
It is interesting that the culture war, I mean, I think they must feel that they get some value out of coming across as being anti-corporate. Like, there's this, This is our way of being populist without actually being populist.
Well, I think like what you can exploit is the fact that the right is now almost less interested in like reasons to govern than it is a bunch of individual agents who have an incentive to get popular among right-wing media. And that's what like that's what focusing on Dr. Seuss, focusing on, you know, the Coca-Cola company or whatever corporation they are mad at that week, like it's less about a sort of like right, like it just being yelling about that is a way for lawmakers to get on Fox. It's a way for conservative pundits to get more attention for themselves. And like when your incentives as a political movement are almost entirely tied to your own sort of media ecosystem, you know, you are just encouraged to play up these trends, right? To chase trends instead of actually trying to set an agenda.
And it's the monolithic nature of their own media ecosystem that is really what we're seeing. Like, right? Like you know, so Joe Manchin has his incentive to play to his media ecosystem, but it is a niche,
right?
Right? It's West Virginia and, you know, specific sort of like voters who would vote for him even though they voted for Trump.
Yeah.
That is very different than the niche that Bernie Sanders or AOC or, you know,
or even Sinema's operating in, right? They're kind of doing the same thing, but she's doing it. Arizona's ecosystem is super different.
Yeah.
That is interesting. And this was always, this has been a dynamic that's been going on for years on the right. It seems like it's just that it has reached, it hit some type of critical mass during the Trump years.
Yeah.
I don't think it hit it because of Trump. I think Trump happened because it had.
Yeah, it was a culmination of trends. And I think what's interesting too is that we're talking like the conservative media is a national media too, and like, you know, so for a to use the most extreme example, like for a Marjorie Taylor Greene, like it doesn't matter what district she represents. Like what matters is like she got it. She's getting attention, focusing on substance-free culture war issues and conspiracy peddling for a national audience. And you know, I try to think like you almost couldn't do like the average left-wing politician is sort of trying to get the media to care about their concerns. And on the right, it's like you just figure out what the right-wing media is talking about, and then that is now your concern.
Right. Right. Like there was not a lot of right-wing politicians out there who were like steaming quietly about this Dr. Seuss thing. Yeah. And then all of a sudden we saw this back like with Terry Schiavo, mm-hmm. right? I mean, mm-hmm. that, like, it's not like there, this was, we've been debating this question of, you know, who has authority in the situation. It was just like, this is where they're going and that's where we're going to go. But the Schiavo thing was like a almost like a broader cultural phenomena, and they just chose a side on it.
Yeah.
As opposed to just sort of creating it from whole cloth on right. some level. I mean, Gates is going with Marjorie Taylor Greene on this tour that she's taking.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that is a great example of like, you know, last refuge. I'm going to like, this is how I, get back into the flow. That is.
And I wonder if the MAGA heads' pedophilia concerns will reemerge once they see Gates alongside QAnon Princess Marjorie Taylor Greene.
It's going to be an interesting sort of moment of I wonder if there'll be like counter protests at these things.
I
tend to doubt it. But you also wrote a piece, Alex, if you weren't aware, of the new phenomena. It's not like Republican state legislatures are passing no laws. They're also now making it more convenient and safer to drive your car into protesters.
Yes.
Please do. And of course, this is not a theoretical
right. Yes. Issue. Yeah, it would be right, because otherwise it would make no sense. Why would that, if this was not something that had happened, and if this was not something people were interested in allowing to continue happening, it really would make no sense for any legislature anywhere to address the issue of criminal and civil liability when you drive your car into a political demonstration. But in Florida, they have now made it so that there will no civil liability for if you are sued for injuring a protester with your car. And
in Oklahoma,
right? Yeah, I was trying to remember. Iowa. I think I'm not sure if it's passed the Iowa Senate. They have a similar bill in Iowa. Oklahoma has taken away criminal and civil liability, which is staggering. And they're doing this as basically car attacks on protests have become what they were once, a sort of rare thing, and they have become a sort of more common practice. And I mean, here's the thing that really disturbs me about this is that there were a spate of these bills just a couple of years ago. The ACLU was tracking them. The ACLU calls them hit and kill bills. So when the sort of tactic, and the right wingers, like especially the far right, when they're organizing online, they absolutely consider this a tactic. When the tactic of driving into protesters got more common, the one response on the right was to start putting these bills out in state legislatures. A couple years ago, all of them failed. This was sort of beyond the pale. No one wanted to be, you know, it was like the fringe idea. It couldn't even pass in these Republican states. But now, 2021, these things are actually starting to pass. That's incredibly disturbing. What I described it in the piece I wrote is because these bills, like, they couch it often in terms of self-defense. The Florida bill, for example, makes it very easy to label any demonstration a riot. And then, therefore, if you drive your car into it, it's because you are fleeing a riot. In presenting it in these sort of self-defense terms, I was scared for my life of these people protesting. So therefore, I'm not liable for hitting, injuring, or killing them. They're just sort of recreating their own legal justifications for, like, shooting people and applying it to cars. Like, this is sort of stand your ground, Second Amendment style policy applied, taken from the way they treat guns and applied to cars for many of the same reasons.
And Brendan, just our producer, just pointed out this it's insane that they're doing this after Heather Heyer.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
The murder, and that was, you know,
of Heather Heyer murdered. Yes, right. And Heather Heyer was murdered by a person driving a car, and that was I think the reason why a lot of those bills didn't pass a few years ago. But then, like, they've had more time to sort of normalize the idea amongst themselves that this is a good thing.
To be clear, under the Oklahoma law, maybe you don't know the answer to this, and I suppose that in the case of Heather Heyer, maybe, you know, there may be an opportunity for the DOJ to come in and press charges from a federal level. I'm not sure. But in Oklahoma, had the James Fields, the murderer by car of Heather Heyer, had he done that in Oklahoma now or going forward, is he just, there's no liability?
I mean, it would. This is the way these things are worded is it creates an out for my impression is it creates an out for prosecutors who don't want to prosecute, because most of these bills, as I said, phrases it in self-defense language, and so it would be up to whatever prosecutor was there to say, he feared for his life from this protest. You know, and you know, that's arguably, like, this is the other thing about these laws, is that this Oklahoma law was prompted by someone who drove a pickup truck into a Black Lives Matter protest and paralyzed someone. That person, this happened in Tulsa, that person said he was scared and was not charged. Like, again, making it unclear why we need this law if certain people could already drive into protests and paralyze someone and not get charged for it. But I think that would be the situation here, is it would just create, you know, the more excuse for a prosecutor or for police not to arrest someone and for prosecutors not to charge someone who did this.
Yeah. And prosecutors, of course, have never had a track record of, when it comes to Black Lives, basically siding with police. And when it's a Black Lives Matter protest, I would imagine that is going to be even, you know, exponentially increase the likelihood that they're going to be more amenable to not charging somebody.
And, you know, when I wrote this piece, there were some people in my on Twitter talking about it. And they were like, well, you know, the people who write these laws will be sorry when, you know, left wingers start driving into anti-abortion protests. I'm like, I hope you do not think this law would be applied equally to that. I just don't, like, it's all prosecutor's discretion and, you know, and maybe eventually what juries will decide. But it's hard to imagine this law giving cover to other sorts of people who use vehicles as weapons.
I mean, that's you know, that type of response on Twitter is indicative of it, just like the whole sort of anti-cancel culture moment we're living in. It's like, you know, or corporate censorship.
Yeah.
wait, you think that corporations have not been censoring since the day that they were in a position to broadcast or publish anything? Like,
yeah.
What do you, that's literally their job, is to is to censor things. And the idea that they're not censoring, you know, the left more than they would the right in this country, there has never been a moment where that hasn't happened. That's what they do.
Yeah.
That's like the idea of, you know, the question is just, is there any opportunity for the left to have any outlet, is really the question.
Yes.
Not whether corporations have been censoring for the dawn of their ability to censor in any fashion whatsoever. That's the strange thing about it. It's just sort of like, and also, you know, like, let's be clear. I have no doubt that there are opportunities where someone would drive a car into anti-abortion protesters. But I would be willing to bet that if we were to look at the 70 instances of those cars going into protests,
yeah,
that it's not, you know, some guy or woman, you know, driving into a neo-Nazi protest.
Yeah.
That the vast majority of those go literally in one direction. And I want to make the point about the civil liability. That is a big deal, because yeah, that person who's paralyzed in Tulsa, they're going to require hundreds of thousands of dollars of care, maybe millions, over the course of their life.
Mm-hmm.
And where they get, you know, like, where does that come from?
You would know the law better than this, but like, if you're just hit by a car when you're walking down the street, like, it might be the case of that driver didn't necessarily violate the law, but would still be civilly liable for injuries you suffer.
Without a doubt. If the facts of the case were such that, you know, yeah, like, if you're on the sidewalk and the car comes up there, they're civilly liable. Their, you know, maybe their insurance company covers it or whatever, but there is a tortious action there. And
if you're part of a protest and the car drives into you, it's like, oh, well, sorry, out of luck.
Your shield. I mean, that is absolutely, nuts.
I mean, yeah, I think people should really be very disturbed by this and keep a close eye on it.
All right. Lastly, you had a really fascinating piece about Andrew Yang, and we only have a couple of minutes left, but I want to talk about this. New York City, obviously, most prominent cities in America is what I've been told. And there is a mayoral election only 2 months away. And New York City voters seem to be, for the most part, broadly speaking, consistently disengaged when it comes mayoral races. And I don't mean just this year. I mean, like, forever and on some level. And the Democratic primary election is in June. There are, I don't even know how many candidates, but a bunch. And Andrew Yang has been consistently polling higher than everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
It is a ranked choice voting, but it's hard to, so it's in polling, you know, for it's tough.
Really, it's this is an impossible race to poll, especially because it's the first time we're doing ranked choice voting. But I do think the polls are still consistent that he's got the most support.
The one progressive in the race, well, we can talk about Andrew Yang's progressive bona fides, sure. But the one sort of person that people are starting to coalesce around, Scott Stringer, has just had some pretty bad accusations levied mm-hmm. against him that seem, at the very least, at first blush, fairly credible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think his response to, are there any other relationships that you had with interns? And he said, not that I'm aware of.
Yeah, that wasn't great.
That's not exactly, that doesn't give you a lot of confidence about that. But so give us your take on Yang, because it's fascinating.
So Yang, I mean, I think people have been trying to explain Yang's popularity and especially when he's never been involved in New York politics whatsoever. How does he waltz in here, suddenly lead this entire pack of seasoned politicians? How does it happen? People are like, well, it's his enthusiasm for the city. People like that he's not a progressive like Bill de Blasio, or that he's not associated with Bill de Blasio's sort of version of progressive politics. I think it's like it's name recognition and celebrity. And I think that that's really goes a long way toward explaining it. And I refer to Yang as a celebrity politician. Usually Democrats don't go for celebrity politicians in the sense of people who are famous for one thing and then go into politics. And if you look at the history, most of the people for whom that's true are Republicans, from Sonny Bono to Tommy Tuberville. Like, that's generally a like Republican, we can debate the reasons why. But when celebrities try to run for things as Democrats, a lot of the times they don't win because Democrats like competence and experience. And, you know, they like serious, like competent people with experience. But Yang did a funny thing where he became a celebrity by being just some guy who ran for president and then was on TV, like on during a presidential election on TV in debates that millions of people watched as like a credible politician. He became a credible politician just by like sort of being on TV. And I think that like that goes a long way to explaining how Democrats are accepting him. And I don't want to downplay, he is a gifted politician in the sense that like he's enthusiastic and people seem to like him. And he was smart enough to associate himself with one particular policy in UBI that is extraordinarily popular among regular people. And so I think that there's a little bit of a, I would argue based on the people I know of who are running his campaign, a little bit of a bait and switch where people think that they're getting a sort of progressive who backs UBI. And we can get into this more, but he's essentially the lane he's running in is the candidate backed by the business class in New York.
Say, Sam, just that this UBI proposal, I'm looking at the excerpt now, an average of $2,000 a year to be given to 500,000 low income recipients. And it's $1 billion a year, which they're reallocating by resolving inefficiencies in social programs and reallocating some current assistance like homeless services that he says may be made duplicative. So he's essentially repurposing social programs for poor and homeless people for a watered down garbage UBI proposal.
It's a BI. The U is no longer applicable, but right. I actually think that like,
but it's also not a BI. It's not a B. It's not universal, and it is not basic. It's not basic income.
It's a heavily means tested sort of pilot program for a new sort of welfare benefit that.
It's supplementary income, and its revenue also relies on philanthropy. So it's not even a pilot program for something that has sustainability. It is all at the whim of wealthy people who decide, you know what, this year I'm not giving to it. And so it's gone. After they've cut these other programs, then it's gone. He gave away the game. He told Dave Rubin this, of all people, during the campaign. I wish we had more time, but we'd also should say is that his campaign is being run by a corporate lobbyist who was Bloomberg's guy.
Yeah, Bloomberg's
guy. And also represents police unions.
Yeah.
Yes, they're not cutting the they're not planning on cutting the police budget a dollar.
But I think your insight about him being a unique, his celebrity being created through politics, is a fascinating insight. And next time you're on, we will extrapolate and talk about that more. Alex Perrine, always a pleasure. Folks should go check out your writing at the New Republic. And of course, listen to the politics of everything. We will see you again soon.
All right. Bye, Sam and Emma.
Thanks, Alex.
All right. Quick break. We'll be right back. Wrap this up for the week. We're back. Quite a week. You know, I didn't even have time to mention Alex's haircut. I noticed he got a haircut.
Yeah, he no hat for Alex today.
No hat and a haircut. I have yet to get a haircut in a haircut place.
Yes.
I'm yet to get one in any place.
Sam cuts off little pieces from here.
And then wonders why his hair sticks up all over hell.
Yeah.
Well,
exactly.
No, it's when the hair sticks up is when I cut it off. Emma has watched me just sort of like, and she's just screamed, "You can't use a dull scissors." And I'm like, "It works."
He's using office scissors to cut his hair in front of me at the desk.
Well, it's not so much that I'm doing it in front of you. I'm looking at the camera. I'm seeing.
Well, you're doing it. The fact that you're doing it at all is, I mean, you need, you know, it's like, that's not right.
We will discuss this more at the beginning of next week. If you're leaving us now, we will say adieu and see you on Monday. And if you're sticking around, we will say, just kidding, we weren't leaving. We're still here. Say goodbye to the Peacock folks. Speaking of which, you know, Em and I are doing extra interviews on Peacock every day at 5 p.m. in the we haven't quite, it's still sort of branded as the Majority Report. I don't know if we're going to change the name on it or whatnot, but it's just interviews. Emma does one. I do one more often than not. Sometimes maybe Emma will do two and I'll do none. And sometimes I'll do two and Emma will do none. But some good interviews. I interviewed this guy, David. What did I say his name was? I can't remember. Roy, he's writing The Atlantic, and
want me to check the calendar for you?
Yes, he is a member of the. Am I saying this right, Matt? The Ojibwe tribe from Leaks or
Leech? Yeah, Ojibwe. Yep.
Yeah, Ojibwe, and he wrote about
David Troyer.
David Troyer. He wrote about this idea of essentially giving the national parks back to the tribes who
done should be done. Absolutely.
It is. First of all, it's a very compelling piece of writing. He's a great writer, but it is such an obvious idea, such an obvious win. And to be clear, it would be with a covenant, and the baseline would be, they need to operate it in no less of a conservatory way than the federal government is today. And the parks people over the course of the Trump administration were terrified that Trump was just going to basically sell off all of it. And remember, he had hostility towards these parks people from day one, when they were responsible for saying, like, only 15 people showed up at your inauguration. Sorry. And Trump went and, like, reversed an Obama decision to expand. I can't remember which national park was, but and lopped it off by 80%, the entire park. And so there was a lot of fear there. And this would protect the parks, A, from that type of political back and forth. B, it would restore some sense of justice. I mean, it's not, you know, full reparations, but the genocide of the Native Americans and their dispossession of land in particular, you know, what better way to pay back land owed than to return land? And it's just such an obviously great idea that I was just sort of shocked that this has not been something that people have been talking about for decades.
Yeah. Now that you mentioned that, David Treia wrote The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, which is a really good book.
Yep. Yep. That is now on my reading list, but that's just an indication. Like what have you had one, Emma, that you like most recently?
Oh my God. I mean, I've had so many great interviews. Let me, now I got to pull up the calendar.
I know that's the amazing thing is like, I can't remember anything.
I know. Well, yesterday I interviewed, and it should come out, it comes out a week from when we do the interview?
Yeah, I think.
People ask, and I don't know what the...
I always say, it's going to come out probably within a week, and then it'll be up for 30 days.
Oh, okay, I'll add that other part. But I interviewed Nina Burley yesterday. She's an author, and she wrote a really great piece in The Nation about what you have referenced so many times, Sam. I should send you the piece. How there was like this collective amnesia in the culture about the 1918 pandemic and about.
Oh, that's interesting.
And so she looked back. There was anti-maskers back then, and it was also a period of racial unrest and protests and riots, and basically she examines whether we will choose to forget this time and we'll choose to respond. So it was a great discussion yesterday. And so that should be out next week. There's so many great interviews with like experts. And then one of them we put out on Ring of Fire, but the rest of them, if you want to actually watch, you can check it out on the Peacock app.
You can catch some of those on Ring of Fire as well. So check it out there. Just a reminder, majoritydiscord.com. Our Discord community has grown in leaps and bounds in just the 2 weeks that it's been up. We now have over 2,000 people who have signed up for the Discord. The great thing about the Discord is if you're on Twitch, if you're on YouTube, if you're on Facebook, if you're on Twitter, and you're in these conversations during the show, after the show, where do you go to chat about stuff that we did on the show or just to, you know, mock me or something like that? Well, you go to majoritydiscord.com. And I don't know if we're plugging it yet. I can't remember what Kyle told me, but we are about to have a Twitch. I will hold off on that. I'll just say poggers. It's a big deal, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, just say poggers. Poggers.
Also, don't forget, you can support this program by becoming a member. Join themajoritireport.com. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority, get 10% off. And we have also Nomi Show. Fridays are Femme Friday on Nomi Show. I think that means it's very feminine.
Right.
So they
you had a little flair to it.
Not with cigars, not with scotch, because that's just for men.
With rosé and rom-coms.
That's right. Exactly. Spritzers, wine makeup. Spritzers. And check that out at youtube.com/TheNomiKey Show. Matt, what's happening on Left Reckoning?
Oh, we had a great night last night with Ben Burgess on the public half. We talked about canceling comedians while the world burns. Got in deep about his book, which I really like.
how'd that go, Matt? That was good.
Yeah, it went well. And honestly, like there was, I made my points plain about the arguments in this genre that I have little patience with, and Ben doesn't make any of those. So we talked about that a little bit, and also talked about, and Ben joined us in the post game, just kind of impromptu, and we had a lot of fun there. So that's patreon.com/leftreckoning for members if you want to hear that.
Nice. I'm gonna listen to that because I was preoccupied with the draft last night. I maybe overindulged a little.
What do you mean overindulged? In drinking?
Yeah, a little bit.
During the draft?
Well, my sister came over. We're all vaccinated. Her boyfriend, the four of us watched together. And the Giants traded down to 20, which I loved.
All the people that you're watching this with, are they all like as into the draft as you are? I mean, what's the dynamic?
Well, my boyfriend is. I mean, that's why. But, that's the only way you could be with me, obviously.
It would be hard to imagine, like, a non-sports fan is your sister and his?
My sister's a Pats fan. So you would like that. She and her boyfriend's a Jets fan. And so he was really excited. The Jets had two first-rounders. And I think they killed it. And the Patriots drafted Mac Jones last night, quarterback. We'll see. He's like the most, he looks like a really bland white guy, but he played tennis and he's got great feet and he can throw. He can throw it, but of course the Patriots take like a, Alabama white dude anyway. So there we go.
Also, folks, I want to remind you, amquickie.com. And speaking of amquickie.com, guess who's joining us now? Right now is Lucy Steiner, who is the co-host of the AM Quickie. On 1 week, 2 days a week, I will record the AM Quickie. And on the other week, Lucy will record 2 days a week. And then sometimes I'll do three and she'll do three. And when she's not doing that, Lucy, welcome to the program. What's your new podcast?
It's called the Kump Podcast. I host it with Ray Kump, fellow comedian, boyfriend, husband, whatever you want to call him.
Why does he get the name?
Well, because it was his. We had a podcast before called Our Love is Disgusting. And then I joined the Kump Podcast to produce and co-host. That's a fun podcast. The audience doesn't love politics, though. I'm going to talk about politics here. They like doing deep dives into like Ray's dental issues.
Into what?
Into Ray's dental issues. He has persistent dental issues.
Oh, okay. Into
and
Ray's.
He used to work at a morgue.
He did?
Interesting guy. It's like,
that'd be fascinating.
I've always wanted to meet somebody who worked at a morgue just because I feel like it's.
I read a memoir and it was fascinating. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, every time I talk to him about the morgue, I'm like, so did you cry then? Did you cry then? He's like, no, I didn't cry at all. I was like, I would cry every day if I worked in a morgue.
How early did that come up in your, in the development of your relationship, the morgue thing?
Immediately. He couldn't wait to tell me. So how's it going, Sam?
Well, wait, I'm just,
is everybody attacking you?
I want to I mean a little bit, I just want to hear like how that developed. Like you're like, oh my God, this guy worked in a morgue. I finally found the one.
Well, look, you gotta be a strong guy if you work in a morgue. I would assume, or a very weak guy. I don't know. I don't think there was anything in between.
Was it the smell of formaldehyde that you were like, that's pretty good.
The episode I sent you, I had been scrolling YouTube and I was looking at like, the thumbnails on Ben Shapiro, and it's like every thumbnail is like a different black guy in the thumbnail in Ben Shapiro. This guy is really, he really doesn't like black people. I don't know.
For some reason, his audience gets really excited if there's a black person in the thumbnail of his videos.
I don't know.
You don't get the way that guy talks, you just know he doesn't like black people. Like you can't have that cadence and that voice. And it's too
uptight. It's too pent up.
Right.
It's too pent up about it all.
Stereotypical nerdy. Yeah, go on.
We should have saved the Ben Shapiro clip for Lucy. But...
Well, we had to open with that because it was that ridiculous.
Oh, was he mad?
he was mad.
But it was at a white guy. So that's why we played.
Oh,
it.
Wow. That's
special
new.
And unique. Since we're talking about, overt racism, let's play a clip from Tucker Carlson.
Good.
Shall we?
Yeah.
Now look, Joe Biden during his speech referenced the January 6th attack on the Capitol as being the biggest threat to democracy since the Civil War. Now, I think there's some hyperbole associated with that. Like you could say, right? I mean, you could say like, I think like COINTELPRO.
that was pretty bad.
Right. And a lot of stuff that, J. Edgar Hoover with the FBI was doing. And I think.
Yeah, him trying to get Martin Luther King to kill himself, I think was worse.
and then actually killing civil rights leaders, too.
Right. Yeah.
And, because you shouldn't do that in a democracy. You shouldn't kill your political opponents.
That's not nice.
But to be fair, these folks were threatening to kill their political opponent. I mean, to be fair, but we're weighing this. I think you have an argument that after 9/11, a lot of the spying that that was done by all the federal agencies was a threat to democracy. I think you could also argue that voting attacks on voting rights, a threat to democracy. And during wasn't there a plot at one point against FDR by fascists in the 30s?
Oh yeah,
the business plot. Yeah,
yeah. So, I mean, yeah. It's like I try to separate these things out. I try to be fair about it. Like it's like I don't necessarily care that some guy put his feet up on Nancy Pelosi's desk. Like I tried to care, but I was like, look, it's like I get why a citizen of the United States would want to do that to any political leader, put their feet up on their desk. That's sort of an American attitude. It's just more like, to the extent that, some of these folks were trying to hurt people, that's no good. Well, it's like,
I would even go further though, because they definitely, some of them anyways, definitely thought that this was going to change the results of the election. There's no doubt about it. I mean, that was what the attempt was. And I don't know. I mean, could it have worked? I don't know. I mean, probably not, but maybe. And so I think that I would put it in the top 10. I don't know where I would rate it in the top 10 or 5 since the Civil War, but I think it's up there.
And you can make a broader case about just Trump lying about the results, saying that they were illegitimate, and then thus the Capitol insurrection.
Yes, focusing on January 6th is like this is an entire era we've lived in where Trump went the entire post election phase of sowing doubt and amping people up for this. And January 6th is the last time something like that's going to happen. I mean, a few days before Christmas, there was stuff in the Oregon State House where they were storming that. So, I think. But I agree that it's saying too much to say it's the biggest one since the Civil War because people just have too many available counterexamples. But it definitely was an attack on democracy.
Yeah, I feel like in general it's fair to say that it hasn't been great since the Civil War. it's been pretty tense.
But I want everybody to formulate their own list of the top 5 or 10 of threats to democracy and see if it aligns with Tucker Carlson's.
Since the Civil War.
Really? The worst attack on our democracy in 160 years? How about the Immigration Act of 1965? That law completely changed the composition of America's voter rolls purely to benefit the Democratic Party. That seems like kind of an assault on democracy, a permanent one. But no, that was a good thing because in the end it helped Joe Biden. What's bad is when anyone other than Joe Biden has power. That's an attack.
LBJ was really playing the long game, right? He knew that in 2020, Joe Biden would become president and the demographics of removing quotas, racist quotas, to allow people from different countries to come to the United States would all build to this one point where socialist Marxist Joe Biden would win. It was very forward thinking.
But did LBJ know that Ronald Reagan would then also offer amnesty to 3 million undocumented immigrants in this country 17 years later. That would then ultimately help Joe Biden. I mean, so let's be clear. Like, there were 3 million, at least, I think, people who got citizenship under Ronald Reagan. So aside from, like, that being just a, you know, just sort of just like a half-baked conspiracy theory, let's get to the racist part about it. Because the concept that having more citizens in a country is an attack on democracy is bizarre, unless you perceive these people to not be white and you perceive democracy to be the power of white people within a democracy. That's the only way that calculation works.
Yeah, I mean, like, Tucker Carlson is, well, I guess you have to give him credit for being honest. He really does. His main political association is he wants as few immigrants in the United States as possible of who aren't white, right? It's like that, you know, he's pretty clear about that. And it's like, you know, like, in these segments, he's more clear than, you know, I don't even know why he does interviews. He does interviews. He's like, his persona is sort of like, you know, this like walking dissociation where he's like cackling one second, frowning the next second, looking like a confused dog the next. And it's like, it's never sincere. He wants you to know it's not sincere. Like, it's like, you know, it's like, he, you know, that's his thing. It's like,
he's
just much weirder than Bill O'Reilly. It's like, you know.
Yeah. He's just such a, I feel like, obviously repressed WASP. And he wants, like, the rest of America to be exactly like that, as unhappy and, you know, unable to express himself as just like a old school white guy.
Well, I think that it's like, you know, he does a thing where when Bill O'Reilly had the reins there, like, it was kind of, he did like a fake working class thing.
Right.
You know, a fake working class thing. Tucker Carlson does pretty much the opposite, where he plays into his viewers, you know, assumption, you know, fake assumption, false assumption that he's, you know, better than him because he comes from money. Like, you know, it's like,
he's like a racist PJ O'Rourke, is really basically what he's like. But speaking of which, Matt, just chime in for a second, will you? With how often do you hear that Immigration Act cited on Nazi websites?
Well, I don't want people to get input.
Are you always looking at Nazi websites, Matt?
I'll just put it this way. The only time I hear that argument is when it comes from a Nazi.
All right, that's fair enough. Fair enough. Oh, except for the one time that you heard it from Tucker Carlson, who's a not.
Who's a socialist.
Nazi. Just a coincidence. And by the way, that Immigration Act was so effective in cementing Democratic power forever that Richard Nixon won the next election.
And then Reagan and then Bush.
Right. Yeah, then... right. Right.
But like you say, long game. It's
long
like,
game.
It's like that that Bruce Lee punch, the kidney punch, where you punch him in the kidney or something like that, and then 3 weeks later, the guy dies. That's basically what went on.
I thought the GOP was making all these inroads with working class, you know, people of color.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, it's too bad that, like, you know, look, Tucker Carlson also is like an example of them, like, kind of sharpening their messaging because, like, look, some of the things, you know, he mixes more truth in with lies than the average, you know, racist pundit. And like, and it's like, you know, that makes him more, you know, persuasive. And you gotta, you know, admit when that's true, because, like, you know, if you don't, then, you know, you're just blind to what he's doing, to his dynamic. You know, he does like mix in some working class, you know, pro working class rhetoric, even though it's completely, you know, fake. Like, it's like, you know,
yeah. His real lineage is he's the type of person who would have been upset that we, took Texas because there's too many Mexicans there.
All right, I'll be right back.
Okay. Well,
when we do Fridays, I don't get my break, and I need my break.
Oh yeah, you get your break.
My 5 minute break. I'm gonna
get your five. Oh yeah, we're gonna do. I guess we're gonna do Freebie Friday.
Ah, all right. Yeah. Okay, yeah. See ya.
Just so that Emma can't get a break. Meanwhile, Lucy's here, and we can, since we're on this racist roll, let's talk about Laura Ingraham. She had a, it was an episode of the show last night where they had like a bunch of people on a panel. It was like, how are we going to own the libs? Like, it really is fascinating because Preen was making this point. And, you know, I've been watching this stuff, particularly on the right, the development of this and, you know, what we used to call movement conservatism, which was really just about owning the libs. And that was a growing portion of conservative thought in that era. And it now is like, but it was marginal. But I think at the time, like, you know, by 2006, I was saying stuff like, you know, what was on the margins is now like basically the center. And now it's like it is from margin to margin is basically, this is the Republican Party now. And here is a clip from the Laura Ingraham Town Hall Red State Trailblazers. This is your preview to the Republican primary in 2024.
This proposition that we are a systemically racist country. Your reaction?
Well, it's a bunch of horse manure. I mean, give me a break. This country has had more opportunity for more people than any country in the history of the world. And it doesn't matter where you trace your ancestry from. We've had people that have been able to succeed and all. And here's the problem with things like critical race theory that they're peddling. They're basically saying all our institutions are bankrupt and they're illegitimate. Okay, so how do you have a society if everything in your society is illegitimate? So it's a very harmful ideology, and I would say really a race-based version of a Marxist-type ideology. So we've banned it in our schools here in Florida. We're not going to put any taxpayer dollars to critical race theory, and we want to treat people as individuals, not as members of groups.
Race-based Marxism. All right.
Here's the problem they have with this stuff. Who, like, of your non-rabid right-winger, who is listening to this and going like, phew, because this has been really bothering me.
Yeah, I mean, it was like, I remember, it's like, you know, I remember going, being in high school or whatever, like, you know, relatively recently. And it's like, you know, I remember it's like, you know, honestly, it's like, yeah, I can remember specific situations where being a little bit more conscious, teaching kids to be a little bit more conscious, a little bit more sensitive about, you know, race and stuff. It's like where that would have come in handy. Like, it's like, to me, it's just kind of like, I don't know. It's common sense. Like if there's, areas where it's, gotten fascistic, like I feel like people should be specific about those, right? It's like, it's, you know, but it's, there is this like tendency on the, there's this tendency on the right to just like kind of like throw a wrench into something and say, well, that was evil. Like, you know, it's any, some kind of educational program and say, that wasn't good for us anyway. It was good that we slashed it, you know? And it's like, and that's also a strat. That's a divide and conquer. It's not just about critical race theory. It's a divide and conquer strategy, as I see it, for like kind of like educational programs in general. Like, you know, I've always seen it as sort of like this way of, you know, vilifying, you know, teaching people by scapegoating a certain program, you know.
There was a move 10, 15 years ago, you know, to fight back against books like, you know, Mommy and Mommy and, you know, Brian and Kevin Are My Dads, that type of thing. I just think that like the idea of anybody running on the idea of like this critical race theory that is really a cultural Marxism is like, who is that speaking to? It is speaking to their audience, period, though. But I mean, like, this is not something where anybody is sitting around going like, got to get rid of this critical race theory stuff. I mean, I just think that like, and we should just say, just for the sake of making sure that anybody who's watching this appreciates it. we are so much a systemically racist society. Just this week, two massive examples that I can. One is just a personal, is one that I interviewed Dorothy Brown. We'll probably run that in a week or two, where she's outlining things that I had never even conceived of, that how racist in effect our tax code is.
Right.
That it was built upon racist, you know, on proxies for racism. Maybe not necessarily with racist intent per se, but as a function of racism, because white people had all the wealth, they had all the influence, they shaped the tax code in such a way that helped people in white situations. Very much like, you know, in Social Security, when it was first developed, that it just so happened that Social Security wasn't available for people who worked in certain professions. And it just so happened that the majority of people who worked in those professions were Black people or Latino. The other is this massive report that came out that pollutants, there's a specific fine particulate matter, like soot, for instance, has a significantly greater impact on Black people, Brown people, Asian American people, Native American people in this country. And why? It's not because there's something genetic in them. It is when it comes time to build the coal plant, when it comes time to build the chemical plant that's going to burn this stuff.
Mm.
These groups of people have not had the political power to keep it from being literally in their backyards. And so, or highways where you have, you know, particulate matter that comes out of like cars and whatnot. These highways are built through Black neighborhoods. They're built through Latino neighborhoods. And so the way that we have built the country was a reflection of people saying, you know, not here, over there. And over there was inevitably people with less political and economic power. And that meant Black people or Latino people or Asian Americans or Native Americans. And this, it is the case regardless of economic class.
Mm. Yeah. So
that's
counterpoint. Counterpoint. There are some white cupcake shop owners who would rather sell cupcakes to just white people, and they can't do that anymore.
Systemically,
so that's hard for them.
That's hard for them. Cupcake. I mean, and really you could extend that to like almost any pastry. Any pastry. That's just, but nevertheless, like, I just don't like that debate. I just don't feel like is going to have resonance with as many people in, you know, like, I don't think, maybe it will.
Well, I mean, you know, getting back to like the effort to kind of squash any kind of, basically any kind of education on race and history, like it's like, you know, we know that in some areas of the United States, people have tried to literally take references to slavery out of textbooks. Like, it's like, you know, this isn't like a new effort. It's just been evolving, but it's like, you know, I mean, I think that it's like, it should be. One thing that a little bit bothers me is that it's like people view it as an issue of racism, which it is. But it's like, I feel like sometimes we don't like completely internalize it as a censorship issue. Like, you know, it's like Ibram X. Kendi, you know, it's like he's at the center, you know, people scapegoat him a lot, you know, because he wrote this How to Be Anti-Racist book. I haven't read that, but I've read Stand from the Beginning. It was really good. You know, this is a person who did great research, you know, wrote two informed books. And it's like, and basically people are just trying to, you know, earn a place in the educational system. And people, I think, just out of pure racist based spite and resentment are trying to get that censored. You know, it's like, that's what it is. It's censorship. You know, when ContraPoints tries to educate people on, you know, the ideologies and psychology of incels in a sympathetic way, and, you know, she gets penalized for it by YouTube, you know, that should be an aggressive thing on the left, that we go no, like we shouldn't censor these things. Like there, you know, there are as many censorship issues on the left as I would say more than on the right. And it's like, you know, the left should start acting like it. You know, it's like this stuff is censorship.
I just the concept of corporate censorship, I just think is a red herring because I do because you know, look, you can argue that social media platforms are different, and I would. And what I would do because of that is not say to social media platforms, you need to present everything necessarily.
Sure.
I would break them up and make them less relevant if they censor, right? Like, because certainly there are other places that ContraPoints can post that video online.
That's true. That's
true. The problem is that there's not that many people there, and YouTube has become so big that it controls the space. That's a problem. That in and of itself is a problem. And so I would attack that part of it.
Yeah, but, no, I would too. Yeah. I agree with you.
What's the other answer?
Yeah.
Can you do anything? Is that corporation not responsible for what it puts on its platform? We have corporate censorship. We've always had it.
Sure, that's true.
You can't walk on television program and get to a network and get your stuff on there. You can't get a book publisher to publish your book. They make decisions all the time just because the nature of the decision has maybe evolved and is constantly evolving. And it's just now it's just spun around in a certain direction. I think like the concept of corporate sponsorship.
Right.
Is, you know,
corporate censorship, you mean?
Yeah. Censorship.
No,
yeah.
I wanted to.
Yeah. Corporate censorship. Yeah. Sorry. I said sponsorship. No,
we want to thank our sponsors.
But,
well, I would love a corporate sponsorship myself.
But that is like, I just think that if we have a platform that is functioning like a town hall, and there's no other place that's relevant to be on, then that platform's too big in my estimation.
Yeah.
And it is too profitable.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we should attack it that way. I mean, look,
we're gonna go dark on YouTube now. Totally. I totally agree with you. And I think that it's like, I honestly think if any social platform should be nationalized, it's YouTube,
here's, if we nationalize it, the problem with nationalizing is like, do you want the federal government now to be in charge of it?
Maybe not. It's a tough problem to solve. It's more like, and I'm definitely not saying that it's the same kind of censorship as like, you know, arresting someone and putting them in jail for speaking their mind on the street or something. But it's like I do think it's important to be like, you know, to point out when someone's intent is cynically censorious. You know, it's like I think Ron DeSantis's intent is censorious against certain works.
He is a governor. And so when he censors, it's very different in my estimation, because he's the government.
Sure.
But when a corporation censors, I mean, I'm sorry. Like, you know, I don't understand how you hold the opinion that a corporation should not be inhibited whatsoever to spend on political campaigns, let's say. And at the same time say, but they don't have a right to say what's going to be on their platform.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm sorry. Like, how do you reconcile those two concepts? I think that, you know, like there is no way to force a corporation to publish something or to not unpublish something, frankly, that's on their platform. But there is a way to prevent them from being the only game in town.
Sure.
And having them serve a function. There is no reason why we need one YouTube. We don't. I'm sorry. Like, we just don't. And so, you know, that the idea of, you know, it's like when people were complaining and this, they had even more of a leg of a stand on because it's a governmental action. But where people saying, like, you know, like when Bloomberg was saying, like, you can't have, 60-ounce sodas sold at, and people are like, that is oppressive. We don't get our 60-ounce sodas. It's like, well, I want a 5-ounce soda. Why can't I buy a 5-ounce soda? Like, hey, where's my singles for cigarettes? That's the way I want them, but I'm being corporately censored because I can't buy one cigarette. I mean, that, like, it is absurd. It's just a decision that they make on a marketing basis because they're only interested in profit.
And Zuckerberg knows the solution is to break this stuff up too, because, like, that's all I just went on Facebook for the first time in months, and it's like, now you have cross app messaging, which means you can message Instagram and Facebook from, like, the same thing. And that's just to make it harder to split this stuff up. So all his moves, it's not toward the user experience. It's meant to preempt any sort of attempt to break them up.
Without a doubt. And, you know, I did one of those interviews on that Peacock show and maybe I should have her on the Majority Report. It's a fascinating piece from MIT. And she had done a story on, like, artificial intelligence and the algorithms there. And she just realized, like, oh, my God, they can't control this. They have secret algorithm teams. They have three different algorithm teams. I mean, AI teams, artificial intelligence teams. And there's one that they make public facing. That is ostensibly, like, the one that's, like, trying to sell, like, we're doing good stuff. And then there's other two that are just basically trying to expand the Facebook. And the only way they do that is by pushing primarily, like, right-wing, you know, like, hate shit. And
right.
Because that's proven for engagement. Like, you look at emails, right? Like, and I think there is just some, like, I think there's definitely a lot of pay for play with, like, Bongino and Shapiro. But I also think this is a genre and a people who just engage with this bullshit.
100%. And it is also right wing stuff like this is trans partisan and trans ideological in terms of, like, engagement, if you want to call it, or entertainment. You know, like, lefties, broadly speaking, would listen to Limbaugh in his heyday because they wanted to hate listen and also know what he was doing. You didn't get that as much from the right. They didn't want to hear it from, like, Air America, let's say. There's just, like, a fundamental...
Well, that's why the Gutfeld, like, parody of CNN is not resembling anything that is what CNN's like at all.
Right.
Because they don't even like the audience doesn't even need to know what CNN is like.
Yes, that's a good point. They don't. They just have to do what their perception of it is. And so if you watch CNN and you look at the joke, you're like, I don't get it. That doesn't make any sense. That's a great point. Should we talk about Rudy Giuliani?
Yes, please.
Giuliani has an interesting defense about this. Apparently, the story is, we should say, Merrick Garland was confirmed about 6 weeks ago. And his sort of deputies confirmed over the past couple of weeks, which gives some more credence to this story that there was an attempt to get a warrant of from Rudy Giuliani for the past 2 years. But the Trump DOJ squashed it. And so when Garland came in, all this stuff was just already teed up. Here's Rudy Giuliani on Tucker Carlson, talking about, why this is an illegal warrant.
Donald Trump's, they could have been Vladimir Putin's, they could have been anybody's, but they relied on me, the man who had to be raided in the morning. Because I'm going to destroy the evidence. I've known about this for 2 years, Tucker. I could have destroyed the evidence years ago. I didn't destroy the evidence because the evidence is exculpatory. It proves that the president and I and all of us are innocent. They're the ones who are committing. It's like projection. They're committing the crimes. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, may I just interject to say it's, I think, literally projection. So from what we have read in the press,
The Department of Justice wants to know whether you violated FARA, the Foreign Agents Registration Act, in representing foreign nationals, Ukrainians, for pay. You didn't register. They're saying that may have been a crime. We know for a fact that Hunter Biden did that. He didn't register under FARA. He represented Ukrainians. He probably made a lot more than you did. He also represented Chinese nationals, lobbying his dad. And he has not been charged with a FARA violation. Am I missing something here?
Yeah, you're missing, equal administration of justice, which is what we don't have anymore.
Did you notice, though, that Giuliani almost gave it away and then he sort of backed off this? He said, I've known about this for 2 years.
And then he mentioned destruction of evidence.
Merrick Garland wasn't at the DOJ. Yeah. And so his argument is the reason why you get a warrant is because, and this is a narrowly tailored argument, that if we don't search him, he will destroy the evidence. So there would have to be a belief that the evidence was already gone by this point. And so he's trying to defend himself by saying, like, I've had this evidence for 2 years. So it's like, if I was going to destroy it, I would have already destroyed it. And then he realizes, like, oh, wait, my narrative is that this is the Biden administration coming after me exclusively. And this is made out of whole cloth. But wait a second. I just said that I've known about this investigation for 2 years, which means that it didn't start under Biden. And then he says, but the evidence is exculpatory anyways, which is why I'm so mad that they took it.
Yeah. I mean, the Hunter Biden thing is clearly the party line here, because Trump called in to Marita Bartiromo's show. Was that in the morning? Cause he was very drowsy sounding. We covered it yesterday. What about Hunter Biden? What about Hunter Biden? Okay. We're not talking about Hunter Biden. We're talking about Rudy Giuliani. And, anybody with two ears and two eyes, or maybe just one of each, can tell that this guy's up to shady business. And, like, you know, was he even officially a part of the administration when he was making these decisions about the Ukrainian ambassador and involving himself in that way? No, right?
So Biden?
No, Giuliani, a part of the Trump administration.
Oh, no, he was never part of the Trump administration.
Right, right.
The president's personal attorney.
Exactly. Go on, Sam.
Well, first off, there is an investigation of Hunter Biden, A.
Yeah.
B, Hunter Biden, I don't know who he was lobbying when he was working for the Chinese or the Ukrainians, because his father was not in office at that time.
Right. And he's not. Yeah.
There's no doubt.
He is not Joe Biden's personal attorney who is involving himself in current politics.
There's no doubt that Hunter Biden got his jobs because his name was Biden and people thought it was advantageous. That happens quite often in business, is my understanding.
Something the Trump kids would know nothing about.
Right. But I don't know who Biden was supposedly lobbying. His dad, with all the evidence that's out there, his dad was not in government at that time. So, but regardless, you cannot go to in front of the judge and say, I know I did this, but Hunter Biden did worse. It's not a defense. Hunter Biden, they're investigating him. And if he's guilty of this stuff, good. Get him, lock him up. If he's not, good. Don't lock him up. That doesn't matter. If Giuliani had no legal jeopardy, I imagine he would just say, like, I have no legal jeopardy. But of course, he also wants to get on TV, so he may be psyched about the whole thing.
Lastly, just really quickly, Lucy, did you guys notice how Tucker was leading Rudy to the, like, down the path? To kind of get him out of trouble there. He was like, so this is like, let me craft this narrative for you, my guest that I'm supposedly interviewing as a journalist.
Yeah, totally. No, he does that. Yeah. I remember, I'm doing that with Trump too. You know, it's like he leads people.
he must be sitting, like, his internal dialogue must be like, this guy's such a lunatic and an idiot. This is easy. I mean, yeah. I go on TV every night, spout white supremacy talking points and barely any accountability. This guy can't come on and create a narrative that's going to make him sound decent. Yeah. That's got to be his internal monologue.
Tucker does a lot of work for the right in this way. Like, and he kind of catches the short end of the stick sometimes. I think we missed this clip when it happened, but when he interviewed Matt Gaetz, and we, you know, the news with Matt Gaetz coming out yesterday from his former associate about relationships with, you know, underage women, potentially, allegedly. Here's Matt Gaetz kind of also, like, leading Tucker to a narrative that needs to be squashed by Tucker.
Again, I only know what I've read in the New York Times. I can say that actually you and I went to dinner about 2 years ago. Your wife was there,
Brendan.
And I brought a friend of mine. You'll remember her. And she was actually threatened by the FBI, told that if she wouldn't cop to the fact that somehow I was involved in some pay-for-play scheme, that she could face trouble. And so I do believe that there are people at the Department of Justice who are trying to smear me, you know, providing for flights and hotel rooms for people that you're dating who are of legal age is not a crime. And I'm just troubled that the lack of any sort of legitimate investigation into me would then permute, would then convert into this extortion attempt.
I don't remember the woman you're speaking of or the context at all, honestly, but
Yeah, that was when Sam and Brendan, you guys were both out. Matt and I covered that to great. I thought it was hilarious.
No.
Oh, my God. No. He's done something terrible. I don't even remember the context of that.
Oh, Sounds legit to me. I don't ever remember us eating dinner before. In fact, this is the first time I've ever met you. Did you say your name was Matt?
He's done something terrible and bizarre. Tucker Carlson is...
here is Andrew Giuliani. This is Rudy Giuliani's son. He's weighed in. I seem to remember Andrew Giuliani having a problem with dad at one point. I can't, back in the day when he was a younger kid. I mean,
they were estranged, but brought back together because of the beauty of opportunism.
Well, I mean, to be fair, you start to look at your dad, if you're Andrew, you're looking at your dad and you're thinking he's getting older. He's gotten a lot more wealthy since from 15, 20 years ago when he was just a mayor and coming out of, like, now he's made millions upon millions of dollars in Homeland Security contracts and gotten paid a ton of money for all this stuff. And you look
Trump's
at
Trump's lawyer's fees. He was getting paid $50,000 a day to chase the.
No, he was not. That's what he was hoping to get. There's no way that Trump paid him that kind of money. And Trump just basically said, Rudy, guess what? I'm not going to give you the money. But I will quash the warrant into what you've been doing. And so if you're Andrew Giuliani, you're looking at your dad and you're thinking he's probably not going to be with us for very long. So I'm getting a little sentimental, this old money bags here. Here's Giuliani.
So would your father turn on Trump to protect himself if that's what it takes?
I can't believe I'm answering something from Michael Cohen. I don't really know how to respond to this because it's a theoretical. My father represented the president in good faith, and I don't, this is all theoretical. If there
can
was,
can we pause it for a second? Remember just the other day when he mistook the word theoretical for conspiratorial?
Yes, that was yesterday. We covered in the fun half. Who did
Andrew Giuliani? Did?
Andrew Giuliani on Newsmax tried to. He said this is all theoretical. Like, I don't want to sound too theoretical.
I'm starting to feel bad for him.
Yeah, he is not the brightest.
You know, Andrew, it is unusual for a prosecutor to do such a thing to a lawyer, especially like you said, the former president of the United States lawyer. Mm-hmm. This feels like a purely political play here.
Well, it was signed. The search warrant was signed by an Obama judge. And now, look, I don't want to be too theoretical on this, but we've seen just how.
he took conspiracy theory, and it was the wrong.
I know it's either conspiracy or theory about this.
Just that go with it.
All right, so go back to this one where he's being asked. I mean, this is funny because the proper answer is, would he turn on Donald Trump? How could he have anything on Donald Trump? Donald Trump didn't do anything either. And it's really that easy.
Yeah.
But he gets, you wonder, I don't know what Trump could do for Rudy Giuliani anymore, but you wonder why Andrew is hesitating here. Remember there was a joke that Giuliani did, was like, you know, would I be worried? I'm not worried because I know all the bodies are buried here. He said something to that effect in the later.
Right. He might be making a conscious like message to Trump here by not.
Who knows? Who knows?
You know, my father represented the president in good faith, and I don't, you know, this is all theoretical. If there was something that illegal that happened. There's nothing illegal that happened.
Well,
so,
even on the registering as a foreign lobbyist, just to make the point, right? I've made the point that anything else they find they could bring. But on that alone, what the warrant was for, right? You could have up to 5 years in prison. I mean, that's 5 years in prison for that charge that they have a warrant for alone. So, I mean, it's a legitimate question. If your dad's looking, if they're able to charge and they haven't, investigation is the point where they charge, you know. 5 years in prison, or tell me a few more details here about the former president.
Well, what I would say is I do wonder if Hunter Biden's going to be charged with some FARA, allegations that are out there against him. So in terms of that, that's where I wonder. I'm very confident my dad did everything that he did on the up and up. So that's where I'll leave it there. I trust him. I trust his relationship with the president. And I know he's a man of integrity when it comes to his representation of the 45th president of the United States.
Erin Burnett had like a little grin there. She knew that she was kind of role playing as like the prosecutor who's offering Mini Giuliani the plea deal, right? Exactly. And you kind of see Andrew just like drooling a little, like, yeah, that does sound like a good deal. Just give a few details. I mean, like Rudy will flip on him if it comes to that in a second, and it'll be the beautiful grand finale to like all of the Trump allies jumping off the ship. You know,
is this the first time he's showing up? Have we seen Rudy Giuliani's son before?
Well, like I say, I haven't seen him in like 15 years when he was like more or less like a teenager.
Was he like in the news? Out.
He was in the news at the time because he didn't like his dad.
He didn't like his dad. Okay. Like,
well, actually, yeah, 15, 20 years ago. So
we also shared on the show yesterday that Andrew Giuliani was the domestic political ambassador to sports in the Trump administration, but was on the Duke golf team in the late aughts, but was kicked off the team his sophomore year because he threw an apple at a teammate and smashed his club in the course parking lot, like Billy Madison, or not?
Yes, like Billy Madison.
Do you think that Giuliani was sitting there going, when she says, like, you know, 5 years in prison, and he's just like, can I consult with my estate lawyer before I answer that question as to whether he would go?
I also do like how they are trotting Andrew Giuliani out there too, just because anytime Rudy goes on a network that isn't even Fox, and it's like a 50-50 like shot if he'll mess up on Fox anyway, but he can't talk to somebody who's actually going to interview him. I mean, he's just going to step in it. So they've got to put the son out there, you know?
Well, it's also the case that the son is also a little bit of a danger on, to be on anything beyond like, you know, he's on CNN, but it was tenuous.
It was touch and go tenuous. There.
The fumble on the would he flip on Trump? I didn't even. That's completely theoretical.
Yeah. I mean, Erin Burnett was like shooting fish in a barrel there.
Yep. Let's check in with Fox and Friends, shall we? Where they weigh in on the dynamic of private prisons. We should say, just as a reminder, that about 10 years ago, I believe it was, maybe a little less, maybe a little more, the private prison industry was quite aware that there might be some type of criminal justice reform or some type of pushback on the private prison industry. And so they were beginning to tell investors and shareholders, we have a plan to get into the immigrant detention business, which, of course, they have done. But just that's just a little bit of a sort of a backgrounder for Steve Doocy and Fox and Friends.
One of the reasons historically the federal government and state governments have used private detention facilities and private prisons and whatnot is because they're cheaper. Plus, they've got profit motives to reduce recidivism
incentives
and make them better, better conditions, and poor performing operators can be removed and replaced. And so that's why the government has done that. But according to Joe Biden, he just needs five more days and he's going to fix it. So let's see.
It's the opposite.
There are no incentives for lack of recidivism. In fact, they have all of the profit motive for a lot of recidivism.
Right.
We should also say that there are no studies that show that private prisons save money. They do not. And they end up having horrible conditions. And like I say, their profit motive is recidivism. So the concept of prison as rehabilitation is completely off. And not only that, they also have all sorts of outside contractors where they monetize everything. Phone calls, emails, all of these things end up being sources of revenue for people who are cash strapped. And so it's families that pay and any work that they do in the prison, their pay is immediately garnished. He couldn't have been more wrong. I mean, on all the accounts. He couldn't have been more wrong as he
slave labor is very restorative.
I would love to get him in a room and just kind of
Doocy.
Yeah. Just like pin him to, like, please explain how does reducing recidivism help their profits? How
I would say getting Doocy in a room alone would be fascinating. Like, I think he's the guy who you feel like if you talk to him for like an hour and a half, he would break.
I think it's interesting that Emma wants to pin down Steve Doocy, but
I was going to not go there.
Don't you dare.
I'm just repeating what you said.
Don't put that image in anybody's mind, let alone mine. Thank you. But you did it already. So God damn it.
Let's go to some. Let me read some IMs here. Come in, Kami from the 814. When can we expect MR's first Twitch subathon? It'd be poggers. Eventually. I don't know when I got to do that. I also got to look that up and see what that is. Shore Rap, as a Broncos fan, the time between now and June 2nd is going to be hectic. What's Hema's take on the possibility of Rodgers getting traded?
I think it's about time he demands a trade, right? But the Broncos, I think, are the number one destination for him. I think you guys should be really excited. I don't really see another place for him. And you've got like some really good weapons there in KJ Hamler and Noah Fant and Judy, who was overdrafted. But still a good setup. You just need some better quarterback play.
Shore Rap, chances of Majority Report getting Nick Estes from Red Nation podcast on to talk about indigenous issues.
We absolutely should.
Yeah. Let's, can we put him on the list, Brendan?
Sure.
And then
his book, I'm blanking on the full name of it, but our history is the future, something like that. But really great book on Standing Rock and indigenous issues.
Mac Jones has great feet, Emma. Someone's been lurking on Wiki Feet.
I recently, a friend recently showed me that website. It's horrifying. We almost got into a car crash looking at Meghan McCain's feet.
Oh. Like on purpose?
we looked at them and then we tried to crash the car, kill ourselves.
Justine Olpai, what do you think of James Carville comments? Something to it, explaining things in simple language and not jargon? First of all, I read somewhere like Morning Joe went, you know, spent the whole day talking about, you know, James Carville's comments on wokeness. And it was sort of like weirdly defined. And you know what that is? That's just an old guy feeling like he's just not relevant. That's what that is.
Yeah.
And I like I that and that's the charitable view. The uncharitable view is it's an old guy who thinks he's weaponizing something against people to the left of him.
What's confusing about Medicare for All?
He's been, you know, like he's been harping on this kind of stuff for a long time. It just wasn't wokeism before. It was just like, oh, this fancy schmancy, you know, the eggheads. The professors and like, you know, I mean, come on, give me a break. Lefty McGee, Sam, imagine you had a friend named Noam, like Mr. Chomsky, but you were really close and your cute pet name for them was Nomi. Also, this person's last name is Key, like Francis Scott. In other words, your friend's name is Nomi Key. Say it with me now. Nomi Key.
There you go.
You can do it.
No, I don't think that doesn't help because you have to stress the key, like employee. Employee is the guide. Nomi Key employee. Because
Nomi Key employee.
If you do it that way, you'll say Nomi Key. Key. And that's
Nomi
wrong.
Key. Nomi Key.
You just slip back into it.
Well, because he screwed me up. Nomi Key. Matt's fault.
No, I'm helping. I'm saving you. That person was being unhelpful.
This is like, honestly, like...
I think you just have to fire her, Sam, at this point.
I'm going to shut her out from my life totally. Like, just not like refer to her as just like.
Hey, you.
Yeah.
It's Const.
What's up, buddy?
Honestly, the day that she told me her full name was Nomi Key as opposed to Nomi is like I will rue that day for the rest of my life.
I mean, you follow her on Twitter. It's Nomi Key. You didn't know that until like.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't
wow.
Read everybody's name on Twitter. Lefty.
What's Noam Chomsky doing?
National Park Service Ranger here. Absolutely transfer management to tribes. It makes so much sense. Also, as far as broader land back movement, you should have on Nick Estes or someone else from the Red Nation on the show. There you go. Two in a row. We got that. Clowns, Mike. I've never seen a room where I wanted to just go in and punch everyone as much as that room was Shapiro. Unemployed Zoomer. I love the way that they just invented a passion about net taxes to make this point. It is amazing. Like, I haven't even heard of the concept of net taxes. Maxi Marie. Like, I don't know. How much would you have to pay an army to protect your millions of dollars if the government didn't exist, right? Like that should be the measure. How worth it is it to you, right? That's the way the marketplace works. Do you want to give us all of your greenbacks and you cannot be a citizen here? Give us our money back. It's not your money. It's the government's money.
I don't know how much Bill Gates paid in taxes last year, but Microsoft got a $22 billion contract with the Army to fit it with 120,000 AR headsets. So, like, I don't know. I would probably pay as much taxes as they asked if they gave me $22 billion to my company.
Yeah. Amazon, same thing with the servers. Mexi Marine, I find it rich that people like Shapiro claim you can't know what's in someone's head with regards to racism, but knows exactly in the libs' heads and their evil intent. More dumb, smart sounding arguments for dumb-dumbs. Cuomosexual. How the F can you take tax zero income from the poor who don't have jobs or paid slave wages? Germaclean. Ben Shapiro is hurting my head. So much stupid. Stand by your man. There are $36 billion in mandatory Medicare cuts in the American Rescue Plan delayed till the end of the year. Have you talked about this? That is, we did talk about it at the time. There is a statutory there is a statutory obligation. When a bill that goes through reconciliation does not zero out that there are mandatory cuts in Medicare, and that has happened before, and there has always been legislation passed that that patches that up, Republicans and Democrats. It is conceivable that Republicans wouldn't pass it. And if that's the case, this actually could be a great opportunity for filibuster reform. Like, it's just mad. It's just a function of how it's played. I don't think that they're terribly worried about it because it's always been passed. It's always been passed quietly because it's a huge liability for Republicans to vote to cut Medicare. But yes, we did mention it a couple of times in the context of the run-up to the American Rescue Plan. But we had no big, you know, there's no more to the story than that, as far as, you know, it's that I'm aware of, at least. I don't know if there's like concern in Washington. They seem to think there are certain things they seem to think are easy slam dunks and certain things that are not. But Evan from Portland, we need to tax based on disposable income. My girlfriend is a housing advocate canceled by the left because there wasn't enough people of color in her organization in Portland. She was canceled. Okay. I mean, there probably should be people of color. I don't know what canceled mean. Was she fired by the organization? Like, I don't know what that means when you just say canceled.
I mean, yeah, like, were there people on social media maybe who were attacking her? Yeah, I mean, I'm not close-minded to the possibility that it's like that people were a little reactionary towards her, but yeah, I mean, I feel like in general it's good, you know,
to make an effort. I don't think that needs a lot more details.
Yeah, we don't have enough information.
I don't know what canceled by the left means. Like,
right.
Who's the left?
Because I've heard of this, and I thought I was part of the left. This didn't cross my desk.
Well, I mean, that's the thing is that, like, you know, you gotta tell me what that means in terms of like cancellation. Like, look, I've had people literally cancel their membership on the show because we don't have people of color on staff. Mm. And, you know, it's like I consider it a deficit, and it's something that, you know, we're working on and going to continue to work on. But I don't perceive myself a victim of cancel culture for it. I mean, I don't think it's right that she would get fired by this organization. Like, I don't know. We need to know the details. HTX Farmer. Hi, MR crew. It's Friday, which is Farmers Market Harvest Day for us here in Houston on our 2-acre urban hydroponic and organic farm. It's my birthday today, and I'm having a good morning watching the rainfall, listening to Miles Davis' Aura album, putting together organic produce boxes for our amazing customers. Could you please make the day even better and give me a shofar blast? Thanks for all you do day in, day out. Sam, Emma, Matt, and Brendan. Well, and I'm going to include Lucy in that too.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
And here is your birthday shofar. Captain Rick cackling at Panko. I don't know what that is.
But I just gotta say, that sounds like a beautiful birthday morning. I like when you can appreciate the rain. I know that sounds what?
I heard the same thing, and I was like, God, that sounds like an awesome lifestyle.
It was just like, it was said so poetically, and listening to nice music. And then, you know, like sometimes the rain's an inconvenience, like when I have to walk to work or whatever. That's annoying. But when you can just sit and look out your window and it's raining and it's nice, that's a good part of life. I'm happy it's Friday.
That was on the verge of a breakdown.
Don't go in for those nice sentiments, Emma.
I heard myself talk and I'm just like, shut the fuck up.
Yeah, Emma got high. When that's when she goes to the when she takes that break, she's like, I just need to get high to finish out the rest of the show on Friday. That's basically what's happening.
Oh, I wish. I wish I could actually be high on air. I would have such insane paranoia that it would be crippling.
I early on in my stand up career, which is not to make it seem like I had a legitimate stand up career, but I would go up after Cross Comedy and Catch a Rising Star up in Cambridge, and we would do these shows, and then it would be like the 12 o'clock show, and there was like, I don't know, maybe 20 people in the audience, and then just comedians all at the bar. And we had finished Cross Comedy and everybody would get messed up and we would go into the back room and get high in the and occasionally I would go and do stand up, which was, you know, tricky because I'm not someone who can function very well when I'm high. And there was one time in particular, maybe this happened a couple of times, where David Cross literally physically assaulted me on stage in the middle of my thing while I was high, like tackled me. And I was so incapable of if I was not high, I would have been able to been folks, this is just part of my bit, or this happens every time, or David's upset about something, whatever it is. But I was too high and I couldn't sort of assess how's the audience receiving this, what's the best way for me to respond. And I just more or less froze in the moment, and it was really one of the most awkward times I think I've ever had on stage.
Do you remember why David Cross attacked you?
To get off stage.
For that.
Just to mess you up.
It was totally just like, I'm gonna go tackle Cedar. And it was a different time for everybody. It was a different time. It was, because it was gonna be fun. It was funny. It was funny.
Yeah.
But it wasn't funny because I did anything funny with it. It was just funny to see all of a sudden somebody get tackled on stage.
This is gonna go through telephone. It's gonna become David Cross molested Sam Cedar.
I mean, that also happened. That also happened. Let's see. Illuminati kids. There needs to be some sort of ubiquitous education in school on how marginal taxes work. The amount of people who sincerely buy the you're better off to make less because you're in a lower tax bracket or flat tax just seems fair stuff is ridiculous. Heard it from so many people in my life, none of whom made six figures as an individual or households in most cases. Let me just do a remedial progressive tax, marginal tax rate. If you have, let's just say, three brackets of taxes for, to make it simple, 15% tax, 20% tax, 25% tax. You make $100,000 or less, it's a 15% tax. If you make over $100,000, every dollar below $100,000 is subject to 15%, but every dollar above $100,000 is subject to 15%. And then if the marginal tax rate for $300,000 is 25%, every dollar above $300,000 is taxed at a 25% rate, but the money between $300,000 and $100,000 is at 15%, and everything below $100,000 is then at 10%. I forgot all the numbers as, the fictional tax rates I made as soon as I did that. But that's the way that it works. So in 19, I'm picking a number. I think it was around this time, 62, 57. If you made over $470,000, which is the equivalent of $3 million, every dollar that you made above $470,000, but not below, was taxed at a 90% tax rate. So if you made $475,000, only $5,000 would be subject to the 90% tax rate. Not all 475, just the extra 5,000, 90%, 90%. So if you made $475,000, that last $5,000, you would see only 500 of that. The other 90% would go to the government, and you'd have a much, much fairer society, except for the incredible racism that was going on at that time. Stop the meal. If you're wondering why they might not be able to find a woman to sit on their set with them, you might want to check out the PragerU video Andrew Klavan put out about feminism. He's the bald dude we just saw on the Daily Wire cigar lounge with Benny Boy, a real piece of work.
I remember when Andrew Klavan got upset that some like B-rate Netflix show had like a woman like medieval warrior and complained that it wasn't realistic enough.
Yes.
With like dragons and shit.
Yeah.
Did you guys see the Welcome Candace thing at the Daily Wire? It's like this 15-minute video where it's all just like, it's a very like, it's this kind of like weird, the kind of jokes you hear when you show up to a toxic work environment where they go like, we all sexually harass each other around here. It has that kind of tone to it for 15 minutes.
Candace Owens? Going
Candace Owens.
Oh, did
Daily
she
Wire.
Daily Wire?
And they do this little welcome, this like, it's supposed to be funny and light. And they do this Welcome Candace video, and it's them like uncomfortably reading cue cards to her.
Can we get this? Why haven't we seen this?
Brandon and I were talking about it.
Brendan, what is going on? Pat, where are you guys on this?
Brendan Finn.
I think I got it here. One second.
Oh my God.
Is it Candace's first day at the Daily Wire? Or is that the video?
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
How do we miss this?
Do you have any advice for me?
Well, here's the thing. Never go in the dressing room when Noel's sitting.
Oh, pause it. Hold on.
Oh!
The best part about this is it sort of feels like they're trying to get the impromptu quality of it, but we're just going to be in a proscenium stage type of situation.
Yeah.
Right.
All right. Yeah. Go back. Oh. Okay, go back. First.
So right off the bat, there's like a joke that.
Wait a second.
Sexual harassment.
Has he got cotton in his ears?
Right off the bat.
Does he have cotton in his ears?
No, it's just shiny. It's just shiny.
Yeah, just shiny.
Can someone explain to me the rationality of wearing a kippah on your head? How is that rational?
Well, Sam, I mean, you're the only one that gets to make this point. So yep. You go ahead.
You go.
Yeah. I'm only half Jewish. I can't wait in on this one. Okay. Or a quarter. I don't know. I don't know anymore.
So answer your own question.
Is it rational? I guess if you want to, it's fine. But if I see someone, a child do it, I'm going to call social services.
So is this like Ben's like, him living out some of his failed TV writer dreams?
Without a doubt.
Yeah.
Candace, hi. Cool. I wrote something up. You're welcome. And you just got to do it because that's part of the job. All right, let's go.
Do you have any advice for me?
So here's the thing. Never go in the dressing room when Knowles is in there.
Keep your back to the wall and never be alone in a room with Michael Knowles. The guy's an animal. He's a total animal.
He has this horrible habit, I'm not lying to you, of just taking off his shirt randomly. And it is a terror to everyone surrounding him.
I've heard this several times.
Yeah, no, of course.
They're onto us in Media Matters.
But... Right.
In general, stay away from Knowles. I mean, like...
We all know it. It's just one of those secrets. It's like Matt Lauer, It's like...
Yeah. What is the best piece of advice that you can give me?
Stay the hell out of my way.
I am new to Nashville, so what is it I do on weekends?
Listen to your screaming child.
Bring your kids to a playground and just spend the whole time counting them to make sure one of them doesn't get kidnapped.
Are there any Daily Wire inside jokes that I need to be aware of?
Michael Knowles.
There's this really hilarious joke that Ben wants to fire me.
That's the punchline to every joke. Anybody says knock, knock, Michael
Knowles.
It's a joke.
Imagine form...
Please.
The form of this joke, like, imagine if you just swap in, like, Matt Lauer or Harvey Weinstein.
They just used Matt Lauer as an example.
Yeah. I missed that.
They literally did.
They just said that Michael Knowles, so they off the bat make, like, seven jokes about how Michael Knowles is going to sexually harass her. and then compare him to Matt Lauer, and we're all supposed to laugh?
I know. I think the idea is that this video, the
music, like, was kind of funny.
Every other conservative comedy is exclusively about how this is going to trigger the libs. Mm. I mean, right. there is no other.
But there's got to be truth to Noel's being a creep, or else they wouldn't all be talking about it.
They're all creeps. I think it is just like, this is going to trigger. This is hilarious, because we're basically saying we're protecting a sexual predator, and this is going to trigger the libs, and that's what comedy is.
Yeah.
Like, what was listening? I mean, I was a child. Okay, go.
This is kind of weird. I know they're trying to do some kind of the music is kind of Kirby, but it's like, but Candace Owens looks a little genuinely uncomfortable.
What's the least, like, sort of like, what's the most uncomfortable sort of like setting we can set this in? Oh, I know. Put it on the stage and just make it like, all of a sudden people are walking in. I don't know. Like,
yeah. Why couldn't they stage an office? Like, we're welcoming you to the office, as opposed to just
exactly.
Everyone comes in on this black backdrop.
The first time I heard the Michael Knows joke, I was like, okay, whatever. And then it's like, oh, this is like the only joke they do.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
This is the only joke they do.
This is what is known as beating a never alive horse.
Yeah. Beating an imaginary horse.
Let's continue with this. Let's do the employee thing where, you know, new employees show up on the stage and stand there as different people come in to give them advice on how to acclimate them to the thing. Oh, my God. How long is this thing? Is it all like something else? What would you be famous for?
Something else. I'm not famous in the first place.
Oh, God.
A good proper spaghetti alla carbonara is the pasta, the pancetta, or the guanciale, or the bacon, or whatever. Egg, cheese, pepper. That's it. Yeah. You're done.
That's not even my weirdest skill. My weirdest skill is that I can actually play these things on my cheeks.
What?
But no cream, no peas. Some people do this. It's ridiculous.
Ben Shapiro is so boring.
They're so relatable and fun.
Oh, what my God, dude. Who cares?
What about you?
I'm sorry, Ben Shapiro. I'm sorry they wouldn't let you write a musical.
Oh my God.
That whistling thing was unbelievable, man.
I can't.
At what point, Candace Owens? It's way too long. Look, the craziest thing about it is that it's 15 minutes long. But it's like, there. At one point, I don't want to make you guys watch this whole thing. But at one point, they ask Candace Owens like what she's into, and she says, "I'm really into Japanese culture." And then, like, the first question they ask her about Japan, she doesn't know the answer to.
I can't tell from this if the whistling and if the joke is that Ben is trying to impress her, and it's so lame.
No.
Or if it's they actually think it's a skill that is.
He thinks those are genuine. Yes, it's definitely the second. He thinks he's an amazing whistler.
He played the violin to the end of Game of Thrones. He was like, it's the end of Game of Thrones. Here's the theme song. And he played it on a violin like it was a fifth grade recital.
And he sings on camera.
This guy is like. Mom really encouraged this guy. What's going on here?
He's the oldest gifted kid in the world.
That's
right. Exactly. It is. He's Arrested Development as a gifted child.
Oh, that's so well said.
Keep going. This is too good.
Good answer.
I really don't know what I'd be famous for.
You want to circle back?
Yeah, I'll see.
I'll circle back.
If you could add anyone to Mount Rushmore, who would it be and why? Michael Knowles.
No.
Oh, I thought I took the words out of your mouth there.
I would add Billy.
Why would you want to put
First
a predator on?
I think Mount Rushmore is an idol. I don't like idols. I have a very Calvin
Coolidge. Oh, I agree with Ben on
Mount
that.
Rushmore. Calvin Coolidge was very divided about Mount Rushmore, which is why I put Calvin Coolidge on Mount Rushmore.
He just had a great beard, and I'm told that I have a similar beard to Billy Mays. So
you just put him on Mount Rushmore because he has a good beard, and you think that that would probably come through on the rocks.
Yeah, capitalist also. Yeah,
that's really good. That's good. I would add Donald Trump because it would be really fun stuff to watch the left try to tear it down.
They would tear it down.
But like how? Watching them try to do it? Because usually they just, you know, put ropes around the statues and pull them down.
Untalented.
It just would be fun to watch it as an Olympic event.
It would be like a North by Northwest, remember, where they're hanging off the...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What was they the really like us. Ever
had? Worst job I ever had. Well, I was a professional actor for a few years. That was pretty...
You?
I was.
This comes off like speed dating.
I worked at a law firm immediately out of law school. That job was so bad that when I quit that job, I went into the senior associate and I said, I'm unhappy, I hate this, I'm depressed. I explained all my reasons. And after I explained, he goes, you know, you're totally right, maybe I should leave. And then I ended up in the boss's office and I was explaining why I was leaving. And he was like, you just understand that you're never going to make as much money as you make right now.
How good does it feel now?
I have been wanting to send my tax returns for at least a decade.
I'm such a loser for saying this.
Can you just pause it one quick second? Billy May is not a capitalist. He's a pitch man. Those are different.
He's a capitalist. He's classic.
Sorry.
He's like Adam Smith.
I am just so amazed by this. It's also, I think I figured out what the Daily Wire's secret is in terms of profitability. Don't hire editors.
No, but it is edited. Like, they've pieced together like different things to make bits in the edit. But like, they must have filmed this for like 2 hours, of footage.
Jen Psaki says, "Circle back."
That was awesome because that's what they said, and then they used what she said, and it was like, "Wait, who's saying that, Jen Psaki?" Circle back. Oh shit! Let's see what else we got.
All of my jobs. Actually, my favorite job ever was nannying. There's nothing like the challenge of children, and so I just really got into it.
One of my best jobs I ever had, I was a Subway sandwich artist. You see, and it's so you love kids, so you like nannying. I love hoagies.
If you could have someone like a personal assistant follow you around all the time, what would you have them do?
Bring me green juices. That. Kale's actually really good. Even kale, like to eat kale, kale salad. Like I actually like kale. It's like that weird
hot. Watching Ben Shapiro try to act.
This is a lie.
It's so good. You had it? What would you have them do?
Not
anything in particular, just to have them obey me every second of the day.
You want slaves.
I would probably
he does.
Go away.
He totally does.
I don't like it. I don't want people in my business.
Let me just say, I don't handle anything in my own life, as everyone who works at the Daily Wire knows. I have to be steered around like a small child from place to place.
They're well, we're so used to having to do. So I'm like, guys, I don't understand what's happened. You're what's happened.
No, that's right. They carry me to the car like a baby.
Yeah.
They strap me into the seat.
What was your favorite toy or hobby growing up?
Reading. I didn't really do toys so much.
We were not allowed
sorry,
to
I recommended
toys.
This.
When I was a child. We were told that it's,
I didn't do toys.
It's insensitive. This is an insensitive question.
I sound like I was such a just boring child.
I recommended this video and now I'm being punished for it.
Yeah. Like my cigar.
Michael Knowles definitely wants to be her favorite. Yeah, he's
well, do you want to keep going, Sam? Or
maybe we should do this in parts.
it's a new series.
Honestly,
watching Ben Shapiro try to squint his eyes naturally.
Keep where we are in this, and we're going to play it for the next 4 or 5 Fridays.
Well, so the Japan stuff is at 5:08, just past the 5-minute mark. Do we want to go to that?
Wait, we haven't done 5 minutes of that? Are you kidding?
Here, I got
it. Feels like we've been watching that thing for 45 minutes.
I got it queued up here.
All right,
there we go.
Do the 5-minute thing, and then we will. It's probably going to be like 6 to 8 Fridays that we will get through this thing, but we're going to get through it. I promise you. We will get through this together.
My toy AR-15s. I think I actually did have a toy AR-15.
If you could live anywhere in the world for a year, where would it be?
Easily Japan. I know it's so bizarre. I have a thing about Japan. I have this weird obsession with Japan. I've had an obsession with Japanese people and the culture. Preferably, since we didn't say this, but you don't have to pick when. Samurai.
Okay, yeah, that's good.
Samurai.
Do they let women be samurai soldiers?
I'm not sure. You?
What?
I'm so obsessed with samurai that it never occurred to me to think like anything about it.
Yeah, what's like the gender? Was there any sort of
She is like these just like untalented girls IU in college or something who pick something they think sounds quirky and cool. And like they don't really have a passion for it. It's all about the perception of being. And she kept repeating the thing about kids too, right? Like she wants to appear domesticated.
She wants to be the help, yeah.
Yeah, it is. She's not only stupid, but she's just so insecure and desperately trying to appeal to these horrible human beings.
You got to check the comments on this video as
fair,
well.
To be fair, though, she has found her people. I mean, because untalented.
No, they're all exactly like her.
Exactly. I mean, it's really, honestly, like that. That's a very good argument that just below the surface, they're all exactly the same. wow, that's amazing.
Can I show some of these comments on this
let's
video?
See a couple comments. It's a little also, palate cleanser.
Are
just
they
quickly
for her?
Just real quickly, there can be women. There were women warriors, but samurai is a strictly masculine term. So,
oh, okay.
But she's obsessed with Japanese culture. Like, how quirky does that make her?
I think that's escapism. I think when Americans are obsessed with Japanese culture, I mean, I like Japanese culture, but I think there's a little bit because you want to escape the culture that you're in now, and you maybe don't want to admit that.
Interesting.
Interesting.
Matt Walsh, we aren't allowed to play with toys. Everyone, that explains a lot. This is the type of work environment that I've spent my entire adult life dreaming of.
This next one. I like this next one. Daily Wire's embracing of memes is generally one of the best things it's ever done. 340 likes.
You got to embrace
they
memes,
hired
Sam.
To do the editing on these videos and put all the memes in needs a serious pay raise.
I honestly didn't know. You know, I've been a video editor before where I did kind of videos like this. If I had known that people would worship the ground I walk on for superimposing some people's faces on memes, I would have stayed in the business.
What were the memes that were in there? The anime? Is that a meme that is like big? Or what were the memes?
I think it's more like a bunch of random images and GIFs.
Do they mean like inserts. A Jen Psaki going like circle back is a meme? Is that a meme? I'm not aware of that as a meme.
Yeah, they literally just mean like weird, quirky editing things and stuff like that.
No, when people, I've been an editor, so I kind of know this. When people aren't funny, when they're fundamentally not funny or charismatic, the editor has a lot of work to do.
Oh, no. Like, I know, like, we've been doing that for, you know, well before the internet. The idea of you put in these, like, little, you know, like, hey, I don't know which way I'm going. And then it's just like, wow, 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 wow. You know, some strange, like, cutaway that you cut to that is supposed to enhance it. But I thought as a meme, don't memes actually have to travel in some way? Like, don't they have to be utilized by other people other than just one person to be?
Yeah, it doesn't just
you get into taxonomy become. Sam, you said you don't like taxonomy.
Well, I'm just curious about the definition of meme, because I was under the impression that to be a meme it has to be actually widely used, as opposed to just like, hey, look at, I created a meme. It's me doing this.
Somebody's going to make a meme out of that.
No, Sam, that's an NFT.
I'm the only person who's doing it now, but nobody else is using that yet. And I.
Well, they cut to that. They cut to some random clip from Shrek or something. They're trying to do the almost like the Jesse Waters thing. Remember that when he would go around talking to people, and when they got really boring, he would cut to a Blazing Saddles clip.
Exactly. Oh, my God. All right. We got, we'll do five IMs and then we'll get out of here. Good boy, Sam. Yes, you are. Yes, you are. Thank you. Moss Potty. I'd say raising taxes is the number one priority. It's far a more structural change to our society and economic system than getting 2 years of community college. If it was a choice between 2 years of community college and raising the taxes, I would say, you might be right. But it's, ongoing payments for another 4 or 5 years for people with kids on a monthly basis. It is universal pre-K for 2 years, which will help with education deficits amongst low-income people. It is provides more subsidies to healthcare so that people aren't paying more than 8% of their income. It shores up a whole host of things. And maybe the biggest argument is, as a political matter, it's the one thing that's going to actually like has a shot, according to Dayan's analysis. Anyways, it's always snowy in Ottawa. When doing the ad for HelloFresh, Sam said bingo bango instead of pinko panko. How can flex being a comedian if you just leave puns like that on the table? Emma, Matt, keep killing it. Okay. All right. There you go. Benito, Sam, you tweeted on January 6th about the Capitol riot, something like this has been nurtured by the Republican Party for years. How would you explain to liberals who still believe in decent Republicans that the storming of the Capitol was a product of mainstream Republican politics rather than aberration from it?
I'd mention the Brooks Brothers riots as a precursor.
That's a perfect example right there, actually. To start with there, but show me the mainstream Republicans that, you know, you had, I think the majority of Republicans in the House voted to decertify, or pretty close. You had a fifth of the Republican caucus vote to decertify. I'd have to, you know, there's not one thing I would say at this point, but arson is not cool. Aaron is not cool. Emma, how can Aaron Rodgers be the GOAT if he can't even beat his own front office?
Funny.
Wyoming Ryan, I have insurance. Rudy Giuliani, that's what he said. And the final I am of the day. I'm not going to read Prairie Fire Kowalski's, but I can see it up here. But he should check out Letter Hack did a drawing of him. He should check that out. And you should check out, I can't remember Kowalski's name of his YouTube podcast, but I'll tweet it at me and I'll retweet it. And here's the final I am of the week, ladies and gentlemen. Howie says, Dave Gettleman, Howie says, thirdlove.com/majorities 15% off is a hell of a deal, and he knows trades. He also says, my wife loves the product. Thanks, MR.
Dave Gettleman's the Giants general manager. Love it. Any Giants-related jokes I'm here for.
Lucy, thank you so much. Folks can hear you twice a week on two or three times a week on the AM Quickie and the Kump Show. How many times? When does that come out?
We do that. We do a video episode for YouTube once a week, and then we also do a Patreon episode once a week. You can also subscribe to the Kump Patreon. And please read The Wealth of Nations by Billy Mays.
All right.
And Brendan, Emma, Matt, great job this week. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. See you
on Monday.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught. See the truth in the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah.